existing. I am the only one who can't resist. And I believe this has been circulated. Is that right? Well, you've got it. Okay. Now, I am going to listen very carefully. And so we're going to make a start on it until we get the electronics up and running. Does everyone agree we could make a start constructively? Yes. Why are there so few members? Very simply, the Honourable Albert should be here at 9, but unfortunately, when people pass on and babies are born, they don't arrive on the parliamentary schedule. They actually die, and we don't know when that happens. And as we know, the late chairperson of Labour, it's her funeral today in the Eastern Cape. And those in who sat also in the Labour committee, that is the Honourable the Honourable Tierko, the Honourable Van Schalkwyk, are, as members of that committee, paying their respects and out there for the funeral. With respect to the Honourable Manta, she's been deployed there by the provincial ANC, you know, sort of whatever, to represent them in the region, etc. Now, I'm not sure which funeral the Honourable Buyani went to, because he was not a member of that committee, so I shall have to await an explanation. I'm not accepting the apology as it stands, because every member should know by now, when you apologize to attend a funeral, and you are running, and you are a member of a committee that is meeting on a bill, unless that is a member of your immediate family or close circle in terms of the extended, you don't go off. Otherwise, we'd never hold meetings in Parliament. We're all related to each other some way. We could be attending a funeral every day. So we have to, as it were, have some sort of guideline there. And that guideline does apply. It means you give the name of the late person whose funeral you are attending. That is important, and your relationship to them. So please remind your administrators or secretaries about that. So I think we're ready, aren't we, Mr. Hermans? Apologies there. Well, let's have the adoption of the agenda. The rule of Parliament is when there are at least 4 members present, you may open a meeting. You may not adopt anything. I hope that's very clear. But you may open it. So I'm going to put the agenda to you and put... Yeah. No, I'm often overlooked. But, no, Honourable Kachali, I know. It's very easy to overlook anyone who's in the chair. But thank you very much. And can we have someone then to propose the adoption of the agenda? Honourable Macpherson, seconded by the Honourable Williams. Right. And now we're going to go immediately on. And, you know, originally we were going to have the full report of the subcommittee. I was briefed by the Honourable Williams that there wasn't what you would call a full report. Is this correct, Honourable Williams, and you wish to make a proposal?
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, you are correct. At this stage, there is no full report. The proposal I'd like to make is a way forward for this committee is that yesterday during the subcommittee and the previous subcommittees, we were going through some of the clauses and or still discussing those clauses, and I would propose that we continue where we stopped yesterday so that we can move with this bill, because we were going at we were moving along quite steadily, and it would be sad if we had to go back to the beginning again. So I propose that we start from where we left off yesterday, Chairperson. Thank you.
I think that's a very good idea, checking with your colleagues who sat, and certainly I think the Honourable Macpherson sat in that committee. Is that correct? Yes?
Yeah, Chair, I just need some guidance from you, because as the subcommittee, we were, you know, looking at, you know, sort of clauses on what we agreed or disagreed, and then would be sent to the committee for, you know, for decision or voting. Now, because we are in a full committee meeting, I just query what ability we would have to make decisions on this bill when in fact we are incorrect. So I would just seek guidance on how you want to proceed, because it does require a decision on each clause. Now, I would have thought that this would have been best placed to do in the subcommittee, so that a position on each clause would have been brought to the committee, and then the committee could deliberate. And we seem to sort of have now reversed that in trying to do the subcommittee's work in the full committee without a quorum.
Well, put it this way, the subcommittee itself, as you pointed out to some extent, does not take decisions. It puts a position with a recommendation to the committee. We're not making a decision here because we don't have a quorum. I had the prerogative of co-opting people, which we've done in the past. We've even co-opted an opposition member, as you know. But I thought it wise not to do that, rather to work with members of this committee itself. And it is not the first time that this has happened in my tenure as the chairperson and of this particular committee. So I would go along with Mr. Williams' proposal that we're not taking decisions now, but we are able to get through the work. You may interrogate it, disagree with it in the same manner that you would do in your subcommittee. So I do want to proceed at this point. We may do so. Yes?
Thanks, Chair. I mean, I'm happy to do that. I just don't want us to go through the work only for other members who don't sit or who sit in this committee who are not here today to come back and say, but hang on a moment, you've gone through these clauses. I wasn't there. I haven't had an opportunity to make input. I want to do so again. And I think that they'd be fully in their rights to do that. So I just don't want us to duplicate the work that when Mrs. Mintashe and
well, let me deal
come
with
back.
That. I do know that some parties, I know the ANC has what it's called a study group. Other parties may not call it a study group, but they have a similar structure. And from what I understand in discussions with the opposition parties, some of them, when they have the leader, they have somebody who, if you like, is the leader of their party in a committee, or if it's a one-man band, as it were, that person reports. So that they make not only their own colleagues who sit with them in the committee, but also their caucus. Now, in the ANC, we meet religiously on Thursdays, except when, for one reason or another, I am not here, which has been once this Thursday, and secondly, when Parliament changes its program. And we are obliged, as members in that committee, to go over everything that has been there, and for members to get a clear understanding. Because if we worked in the manner that says, if you were not there, we'll go over it again, we're actually going to be hamstrung by people who may one day choose to simply not attend. This is a very good reason why they are not, but they attend their respective party meetings. And in your case, I know they would, and in a few other parties' cases. You brief each other and ensure that they come to the committee strategically prepared with their party position. We all have party positions. That's a reality. So on that note, Certainly the ANC members will not be holding anyone back. And you've got the two DA members here, and the, the EFF, I shall brief her because she's also in hospital. And Honourable Albert assured me he'd be here at 9 and to continue without him. So having got to that point, I took a decision not to co-opt. I can, but I don't think that is appropriate. Do you, Mr. Hermans?
Chair, you always have the right to opt.
But
you chose not to, that's
right. No, I've chosen not to. Right. So, members, I now can read it. Everyone else can. Mr. Williams, we are in your hands and your colleagues' hands who were in your last meeting to proceed. And we are then going to... Are we going to have you taking us through, Advocate van der Merwe, or how were you hoping your proposal would pan out?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, yes. I was... my proposal would pan out by Advocate van der Merwe leading us again through the process. Chairperson, thank you.
No, thank you very, very much. There was an apology we never read out, and that is Mr. Honourable Esterhazen, who's on party business. But we do have an apology from the Honourable Nomsa Machigari, the CEO of the NCR. But in attendance here, we have the DTI. The highest ranking person here is the DDG, and that is the Ms. Masocha, thank you. We have then the CCRD, Mr. Kumkani, acting chief director. And then we have Professor, the National Consumer Tribunal, Professor Maseko. We have Mr. Lesibiba Mashapo, company secretary of the, I think that is the NCR, and Mr., is it Tupang Ingabeni, senior legal advisor, is Miss Tupang. What does that stand for? Oh, no wonder, that's why I didn't sort of recognize the gender, my apologies. Okay, to you. Right, and then we have Advocate Charmaine van der Merwe and yourself, Ms. Naidu, without which DTI would probably not operate. Now, can we please?
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, members. The subcommittee yesterday, we started with the issue of reckless lending, and then the meeting had to be adjourned at that stage. So, as I understand, that is then where we'll be picking up. So the question of reckless lending, the bill provides that credit providers and debt counsellors must report any reasonable suspicion of reckless lending in a transaction. The concern raised by both credit providers and debt counsellors was that this requirement will mean that they will have to look at each agreement and test it for reckless lending. That in itself is a very lengthy process because they need to obtain documents from the credit provider that has actually done the assessment. And the problem is, as we see it, if we read the bill, if we read the act, if we read the regulations, and in fact, even when the regulator explains it to us, it seems very straightforward and easy to determine affordability. But in practice, it does not work that way. So the tribunal indicated to us a recent case that they had where the regulator found an agreement to be reckless, but when that was tested, and the credit provider indicated what they did, how they determined whether the person could afford the debt, there was nothing wrong with the way that the credit provider determined that affordability. So, in other words, we are sitting with a problem that depending on the algorithms in the computer systems of the credit provider, you will have different results probably for each credit provider out there. Now, to expect then a credit provider and a debt counsellor to be looking at each agreement by itself means that they first have to obtain all the information that was used to assess. They need to understand the system, etc. So it means that it extends the period of debt review, and it makes it twice as costly to determine. So that was a big concern that they have in practical terms. Credit providers also indicated, and when I presented before, I said I found it a little bit cheeky with all due respect, but they are 100% right. They were saying, but it would be, could be self-incrimination if, for instance, let's use a big bank, APSA, has their one branch considered the consumer, and they made a mistake, and it was reckless. Now another branch of APSA is maybe looking at a revolving credit agreement for this person. They do the reckless lending assessments, and they find that, oh goodness, APSA has actually done a reckless credit agreement. Now, to require then from APSA to report APSA is not constitutional, because you have a right not to incriminate yourself. So we will have to look at that. That is a serious concern. Like I say, it feels a bit cheeky because we all know that shouldn't happen. But unfortunately, that is something that we have to. And because of your principles in the Constitution, it is a reality. We will have to be careful about that. So the other concerns also were that if these agreements are reported, you're putting the consumer in a position where you're telling the consumer, listen, I think this was reckless. Consumer stops paying, because clearly if it was reckless, we need to see what's going to happen with this agreement. Now it takes a couple of months for the process to go on. The tribunal in the end says, no, this was not reckless. The system is fine that the credit provider used. The credit agreement is alive. Now the consumer is in a position that they've lost however many months, 6 months, 9 months, that they did not pay on this agreement. So even your consumer is in trouble. Now, considering all of these things, the proposal that I think is that there are too many unforeseen implications for this reporting requirement. And I would really recommend that this is something that the DGI maybe takes back and consider as part of their review and see what would be the best solution. There are other ways for us to address reckless lending in this bill. Other things that were proposed was, for instance, if a debt counsellor, because this was part of the concerns that they had, is they say, well, if we now report it to the NCR, the NCR just tell us to go to the magistrate court. So I inquired from the NCR why that is the case. And the problem is that the bill only provides for a complaint of reckless lending to be referred to the NCR. So it must be the consumer. So it is simply a technical problem. Now, because it's a technical problem, that we can resolve in the bill. So I would propose that we rather fix the technical things and leave the things that might have serious implications to the review of the DTI. Another thing that was pointed out is, even when a matter is referred to the magistrate's court, so for instance, a debt counsellor is looking at agreements, and they find all five agreements of the consumer was reckless. There's no other agreement. So there's not going to be a matter of debt review. Then they take it to the magistrate's court. One magistrate's court will consider those five agreements and determine whether they're reckless, and whether they're reckless, make a decision. Another magistrate's court will say, no, you need to be bringing a debt review application before I can consider reckless lending. Now, I think that's also a technical thing, and clearly you should be able to refer the reckless lending in itself to the court, and there is no provision for referral to the NCT, but I suppose that will go via the NCR. So if we can rather fix that, I think that will already go a long way to solving the problem. So the recommendation, the question first off is, should the credit providers be required to report, And I would propose that that is rather deleted from this bill for now, and it is something that the DTI should go and consider. The same for debt counsellors, and then also the requirement that they must always check, because that has the same implication of lengthening the process and increasing the costs, and that we then rather look at things like my question 22 there. The suspension is also something that we need to look at, but the 23, 24, should we not perhaps rather correct the interpretation in Section 83 that a court can hear it by itself, and then rather just fix the technical reporting lines? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, we've had the explanation. Honourable McPherson, Honourable Williams.
Thanks, Chair. I think that 19 and 20 largely came about by sort of my input into those two issues, and I'm largely happy with what Advocate Fenimova has said with respect to number 19.
19.
And that's reckless lending by credit providers. And I think that if we can, fix those technical issues, I think that that mitigates the problem. The only thing that I still have a concern with respect to number 20, which is reporting by debt counsellors, is that the Act clearly says that they may. They are not forced to report reckless lending. Now, I have many people that have come to me to say that, that they have gone to debt counsellors, and only subsequently afterwards did they find that actually those agreements were reckless, and the debt counsellors knew that they were reckless, and in fact did nothing about it because it wasn't in their interest to actually report them, or else, their fees are affected or whatever. So, Advocate, I'm still uncomfortable that the word may exists within the Act as it is, and that debt counsellors are in fact not compelled to protect their clients, which I would think would be their first primary objective in what they're doing. So
are you proposing, Honourable
Mathis? I'm still proposing that I think that debt counsellors must be forced to report reckless lending on adjudication of applications. Then, with respect to 22, Advocate, have we not gone to 22? Oh, okay, sorry, I apologise.
We're just going, okay, as it right. were, clause okay. by clause. Okay. Thank you. Honourable William?
Chairperson, with regard to 19, should the credit providers be... they must report reckless lending. I'm of the opinion that they must be made to report reckless lending, because the reason why this is in here, one of the reasons that it's here, is because if somebody goes to a credit provider and says, I'd like to borrow 50,000 rands, whatever the number is, then the credit provider looks at their possibility of them repaying that debt, their affordability. So if they can repay that debt, and if they pick up during that process that the individual has had reckless lending practices happening previously, then they should be obliged to report that. I don't think it's an excuse of the credit provider to say, oh, it's going to take us too long, it's going to cost us too much money. I mean, we must remember that it is the credit providers that do the reckless lending in the first place. It's not from somebody else. It's credit providers lend recklessly when reckless lending takes place. So they must be obliged to report it when they pick it up. I don't think we should let them just say, oh, well, it's going to take us too long, it costs us too much money, it's going to make credit more expensive. The fact of the matter is this country is over-indebted because the credit providers in South Africa have lent to people indiscriminately. And there should be some mechanism that makes it compulsory for them to report reckless lending. I don't think that we should get rid of this, remove this clause at all, Chairperson. Thank you.
Honourable Williams, let's just go back to that clause 19, if we may. Oh, I see here the debt councillors. That's what we're working on. Debt count. Well, earlier on it had the word may, so where did I see it? It's not a touch screen, so you just go back. The may I saw earlier, right, reckless lending, that was the reporting and the self-incrimination. Now, debt counsellors encountering uncompromising this, if they report this, etc., maybe, and so on, anti-competitive, etc., etc., what is it they actually asking for, the debt counsellors? Because I hear you saying, Honourable Williams, they must report this. Are they saying they don't want to or they can't? Yes.
Jefferson, you're talking about two different things. Clause 19 talks about credit providers. Clause 20 talks about debt counsellors. So I'm saying that both of them should be reporting reckless lending. The credit providers are saying, no, it's going to take us too long, it's going to be too costly, we can't report ourselves, we can't, you know, tell on each other when we do bad things. I mean, that sounds like monopoly and collusion, if you ask my opinion. So it's a very dodgy area. I mean, you know, if Standard Bank lends recklessly to Adrian Williams and Nedbank picks it up, what, they must just keep quiet and say, no, we can't report our fellow bankers. That's what they're implying by this. I think we should leave it in as it is, Jen.
Yeah, the point that we had been on 19, but I heard a reference to, and may be wrong, debt counsellors, you see, which I saw in the next clause. But let's just get back to the 19. I can't do the screen, so someone has to move it. Now, on the screen, I'm going to come to you, Honourable McPherson, maybe self, maybe all this, and both of you, to some extent, are saying, well, I think, Honourable McPherson, you're saying this must be taken out. They must report. Am I hearing you correctly?
Well, Chair, I'm just going basing my position on what Advocate Fenimova said, and she's made it clear that the reason why you can't have it is because it would be unconstitutional to self-incriminate yourself. And that's the problem. I don't think it's good enough that credit providers assess applications, can see that something is reckless, and do nothing about it. But I accept the argument that they can self-incriminate themselves. So it's on that basis that I would agree to remove it. What I still want to ensure is with 20 is that debt counsellors must, not may, they must be forced to report reckless lending.
Let's go back to 19, where you now, I hear you loud and clear, you say, well, yes, but then it must be removed from the Act. Am I hearing you correctly now? If that is the case, it would seem as if you have an element of, you know, sort of, as it were, understanding their side about self-incrimination. But this doesn't hold logically, Advocate Vandermeerwe. If I see a crime being committed, and I am, to some extent, involved on my premises or whatever, I am obliged to report that crime. And I don't understand why this should be any different. Because we're saying we don't want reckless lending, and if you see reckless lending, no matter who you are, you should report it because it's wrong. So I personally, I would not agree on that being removed. I would rather go for must report it. Rather, maybe, yes. But I think regardless of the self-incrimination, if they see it, they must report it. They must report it. If a bank becomes aware that a member of their staff is behaving in a manner to which the banking regulation is opposed or against Basel, they are obliged by law to report it, notwithstanding that is a staff member. And I don't see why this would be different. I really don't. So we may hear from that, but there was a move on to 20 because perhaps of the relationship, and it would appear as if both of the members from the subcommittee, Honourable Macpherson, and the chairperson there, Honourable Williams, would appear to have agree on that point. Is that right? Your position about Clause 20, Honourable Williams? Do you share the same position?
Chairperson, yes, I think that anybody who picks up reckless lending must be obliged to report it.
It's over to yourself, Advocate Van. Sorry, Honourable Kacharia.
I just seek some clarity from the advocate here because, and she would know, I mean, there is no common law provision to report a crime. So we are taking a, and I see the rationale behind it, but we are taking a step further than that. And there are provisions made, for example, you need in financial services, if you saw something to do with money laundering or terrorist activities, you're obliged. That's specifically enacted. So there's no common law provision, but we can specifically enact, which is what we're doing, and I don't see a problem with it. But please advise.
Thank you, Honourable Kacharia. There's just one point before you come in, Advocate van der Merwe, to both the DTI and the NCT. Have you got a view or an opinion on the credit providers with respect to this? Yes, Mr. Komkani, allow the DDG first to go ahead, DTI, followed by yourself, Mr. Mashapa.
Thank you so much. Good morning, honourable members and other people in the room. Chairperson, our view on the credit providers is the same reasons that the advocate has advanced about the self-incrimination, and also that there is a potential for frivolous reporting by credit reckless credit lending. There is a potential for reporting that might be frivolous, and also that there might be uncompetitive behaviors by the credit providers around this issue. So our view as a department is that we viewed this, our position is that it should be deleted.
Yourself, Mr. Mashapa, did you want to come in as well, Professor?
Yes.
Yes. All right, Mr. Mashapa, and then yourself, Professor.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to the members. We also hold the same view as the DTI, but we would also go further to say that credit providers would not have the information to make a determination that the agreement is reckless at the time when they report it, because they wouldn't have requested the information from other credit providers. And also the issue of competition is also important, because you might have a credit provider who wants to take out a competitor by making frivolous allegations. And on the side of debt cancellers, we would recommend that the debt cancellers report, we agree with Honorable Macpherson, they report the reckless agreements to the courts. When they make a restructuring proposal, they must also recommend, they must be forced to recommend that those agreements that appears to be reckless should be declared reckless.
You're adding something, as I see, a little extra. You're saying it shouldn't just be to the NCR or the whatever, it must go to the court, not within our grouping, as it were.
Yes, and the reason for that is to ensure that it's speedily resolved.
Okay, on that note also, we have said that we can extend the reporting by debt cancellers to the NCT as well, to make it easier for consumers.
Now, Professor Maseko from the NCT.
Thanks, Honourable Chair, and morning, Honourable Members, colleagues. Chair, I think the two colleagues have covered the point, but what I was going to add on the reporting by credit providers that's under Clause 19 would be that practically speaking now, when a person comes to ask for credit, they produce certain documents that are required, and the credit provider is required to assess what is placed before them. And they may go on and check on credit bureaus and all of that. But consumers are not always innocent when it comes to reckless lending. They can mislead, as we know, credit providers. So a credit provider will not know what information was produced to the earlier credit provider, so that whenever they make a decision to say that one has lent this person recklessly, they may not be having all that information, and they will not have a right to actually acquire that information, to call upon it from the other credit provider. So just at an evidential level, I think it would be too almost impossible to implement. We can have it in, because I hear the sentiment of the committee and it's a valid one, but it's only the practical aspect, because we would have to deal with the evidence. When you bring the evidence, whether it's the tribunal or the court, it would want to see and interrogate that evidence. And I believe that you wouldn't be able to produce it, because the other credit provider is not going to give you its secret way of how it conducts its business when it assesses. They keep this as confidential information a lot of the time. And even when they come to court or the tribunal, they request that such information be kept confidential, so that much as we hear open courts, but there are certain parts of the information that is evidence that they want to be treated as confidential, because they don't want their competitors to then have an edge over them. And that it's just the practical, the implementability aspect that I think for me as a tribunal would motivate for the deletion of the credit provider reporting reckless lending. Thank you, sir.
It's just, do you wish to add anything, Mr. Kumkani?
Thanks, Chair. Just one thing in relation to debt counsellors. Chair, the provisions in there are sort of aligned with the Companies Act, the Competitions Act, and also the BBB Act in relation to auditors and verification agents. They are actually required to report fronting activities when they verify, you know, BE status. So when it comes to auditors, really, I would definitely support that. But when it comes to credit providers, I think I share the same sentiment as my colleague. Thank you.
So what I would like to learn is, in a very short sentence, Advocate van der Merwe, what exactly would you be proposing as our legal support services to address reckless lending, both credit providers and the debt counsellors?
Chief, what I would propose, if we are retaining the reporting of both, let's start there.
Going to take us forward, yes?
First off, when we get to penalties and offences, I would definitely recommend that the reckless lending in itself is not made an offence, because it is not clear. So in that sense, then it would not be self-incriminating if a credit provider is in fact reporting. We will still have the practical problems of how they will be able to obtain the information, etc., because of the confidentiality, the anti-competitiveness, etc. So that will remain a practical problem that we'll need to see if it can be solved. I'm not sure how it will be solved. In respect of the debt counsellors, they only have practical problems. So what we can do is to define certain things better. So the way that the requirement is currently worded, we can perhaps just give certain definitions to things to try and ease up the practical concerns that they have. So yes, If we decide not to retain the credit providers one because of that competition, the confidentiality issues, then of course that is resolved. If we decide to keep it, I suppose it will also be something about the definition that will indicate where the information is practically possible to be obtained or something like that. So that is the kind of thing that we'll have to do there.
I want to check this with you, Honourable Williams and Honourable McPherson, who've largely sat in the debt counselling. I think you have as well from time to time, have you, Honourable Kachalia? But I think Honourable McPherson and Honourable Williams, you've been there a great deal. Can I check with you, when this bill went into the subcommittee, one of the critical factors that we thought should be addressed was reckless lending. Do we agree on the point? Now, I'm not sure how we're going to address it, because it still sounds like a laissez-faire approach. And, you know, are we going to address it or aren't we? Honourable Williams followed by the Honourable McPherson.
Chairperson, exactly. What we're saying, well, this was the clause that was going to make the credit providers actually think, you know, carefully before they give reckless lending, because if that individual goes and gets more credit, then that credit provider is then obliged to report the other credit provider. And that was the point of it. What the department is saying is, it can't be done, so sorry, you can't change the law on this. And I think that's a very funny excuse to say that, because, you know, it's wrong. We have a situation where our country is over-indebted, Chairperson. That is the reason why we've brought this bill here, to prevent reckless lending across the board, because fundamentally, how can we be over-indebted country if reckless lending hasn't taken place? And it must have taken place on a massive scale in order for this to be in the situation we're in. So in other words, then, money is so easy to get, you know, if you borrow money. It's not a difficult process. So there must have been reckless lending, and this would oblige the credit providers where the money comes from to actually, you know, think again. And if we take this out, then what is the function or the purpose of this bill in its entirety? Because if we say, well, the banks will be overworked if we put this in, and therefore we can't give it to them. Though, you know, those Wonga won't be able to do it. Sorry, they, you know, what is the point then, Chairperson? Because this is basically one of the cruxes of this bill, and I think that we cannot remove it. Thank you,
Honourable McPherson.
Yeah, I think that what we're going through now is one of the chief concerns of what I raised in the morning. But anyway, I think we're sort of getting sidetracked on this issue. You know, if we want to deal with reckless lending, you know, these two clauses are not the way to do it. These are just simply dealing with reporting suspected reckless credit. That's all that this deals with. If we want to deal with limiting reckless credit, I'm very excited if that's what we want to do now in this bill, because then we can start looking at the affordability assessments, the tables, etc., etc. I'm happy if we want to do that. If that's a proposal that Honourable Williams is making, I will second that. These specific clauses just deal with reporting. Now, I mean, there's a lot of things in law that I disagree with, and I think that the law is soft on some things and too hard on other things. But that is the law. I can't change the law. I'm bound to work within the confines of the law. And if the law says, unfortunately, that you cannot self-incriminate yourself, then that is the law. You know, if someone wants to change that law, then that's the place to do that. But that place is not here in this bill. So I totally get the Honourable Williams' frustration. But I don't want us to be sidetracked by trying to fix something that we simply can't, or is in the wrong space to do so. So I would really encourage us to say, look, you know, on point 19, you know, we can't expect people to self-incriminate themselves, and that's just something we have to deal with. On point 20, we can expect debt counsellors to report suspected reckless lending, that they do have a responsibility to do so, and we want to change it from May to must. Those are things we can do. If we want to go down the road of looking at how do we stop reckless lending, because this bill was actually to deal with debt relief, not to deal with reckless lending. I've been asking to deal with reckless lending. So if we want to do that, please can we do that, because I've got some great ideas in how we can do so.
Well, you know, I think we must accept that this is a dynamic process. Honourable Kachalia?
Yeah, I mean, I think, obviously, and the advocate will tell us as well, we cannot, and nor should I believe, do I believe that we should be seeking to change the law about self-incrimination. That's the fundamental tenet of our law, and actually law all over the world. You can't mess with that in any sensible way. However, the question of whether one reports, there's an obligation to report, and how you report, I think we need to, and to whom we report, needs to be considered carefully. Because if we report to the courts directly, then that, I don't think, is necessarily speedy. It will will also open up a minefield in terms of potential vexatious litigation and the like. I must say, I'm torn here. I do think, I see the need to prevent reckless lending, and as Honourable McPherson says, if we look at that separately, that's another issue. But to the unintended consequences of reporting that it will have on the industry, that it will have on clogging up the NCT, for example, that it will have on unscrupulous players wishing to delay the lending of others, to seek a gap, to develop a database of where the gaps are. You're creating all sorts of complicated, unnecessary stuff here. So I just suggest that we consider that very wisely.
No, look, I think that all of us are concerned about how we should do this, and at the same time respect the rule of fairness which prevails in the Constitution and so on. Yes, we do need to do that. So what I'm going to suggest is, we are in the subcommittee stage of going through things in greater detail. We are here broadening it somewhat, but that we may need to flag that for further engagement. We won't pursue it now. And then can we move to clause 21, Honourable Williams, Advocate van der Merwe?
Chair, 21 is very closely related because it is the same. It has the same result. So, in order to report, debt counsellors will always have to look at all agreements for reckless lending. So, I think it goes very much hand in hand. If we could perhaps go to clause 22, or not clause 22, number 22, clause 11, which deals with the NCR suspending reckless. The agreement, yeah. The concern was, there were a number of concerns. First off, that the NCR's role as regulator is being compromised. They're not an adjudicating body, and for them to, because the idea with the suspension was, if it is reckless, you want it out of the consumer's life as soon as possible. The problem is, however, that the NCR is the person who will do the investigation, and then make the decision. So there is a bit of a fairness concern in being investigator, regulator, plus adjudicator. Now, fine, their suspension could have been overturned by the NCT, but that in itself has other consequences. So if it is suspended by the NCR, a period of time will go past before it gets to the NCT and a decision is made. If it was never reckless, then we are prejudicing the credit provider unfairly. If it was reckless, fine, then we are fine. But if it wasn't, and with the uncertainty that there is around it, I am concerned about the fairness of the suspension before there is an actual adjudication, and about the duplicate role of the NCR and as adjudicator and regulator. You know, in fact, I almost wonder if we are not stepping into rule of law here. So I would definitely recommend that if there is a reporting to the NCR, that we take away the suspension by the NCR. We could rather request through oversight of the NCR. They are going to build capacity now if this bill goes through, in order for them to be able to administer the bill and by implementing the intervention measure. The committee could rather, through oversight, ask the NCR how long is something sitting with you if it's reported before it goes to the NCT. And to the NCT, how long is it sitting with you before you adjudicate whether it is reckless. So I would rather recommend that we try and shorten the periods through oversight than allow the NCR to play both police and judge, because that is actually what we are asking them to do. Yeah.
Did I hear you say it could be reported on to the NCT? Did I hear you say?
Yes, Jay, because that comes in the next number. We are going to propose that technicality be corrected, because I think that will solve a number of problems.
Members, we've heard Advocate van der Merwe. I see Honourable MacPherson's hand.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Advocate. I think the chief concern that I had regarding this matter was the time it would take for applications to be adjudicated on, specifically those that are suspected reckless. In nature. Now we know that from the time that it takes for a consumer to come to the NCR and say, I believe that this agreement is reckless, and to that actually being extinguished can take an extraordinary long period of time, particularly that it has to go to the magistrate's court to be declared reckless and to be extinguished there. Now, my concern as advocate is that all through that time, the consumer continues to pay against a reckless loan that they should never have been given in the first place. And I just don't believe that it's morally correct to ask for someone to pay for something which clearly should not have been given in the first place. And they will continue to pay that amount and those installments such until the time that it is declared reckless, which I think is wrong. So it was based on that I made the proposal. I still believe, Chair, that there needs to be a mechanism that if a loan is suspected to be reckless, that a person should not have to pay those installments until such time it is adjudicated. I'm very firm on that, and I can't back down on that, because I think it is a moral issue that we need to deal with. I know that one of the concerns that have been raised as well, you know, that the loan will continue to accumulate interest during that time, and maybe I didn't express myself clearly when I first raised this issue, that if it is suspended at that time, that there is no further incursion of costs or interest or anything. It is suspended until such time as it has been adjudicated. So, Advocate, I leave that with you. I don't know how we make that work or who needs to make that determination, but someone must be empowered to make that determination until such time it has been adjudicated on by the court.
I think that we all share that sentiment that why should you continue to pay when this is actually reckless lending? It needs to be addressed in some way. I think where the problem seems to be is, well, it shouldn't be addressed at the NCR level. It should be addressed somewhere else. I think that's what I'm hearing. We all agree it must be addressed. Yes, Professor Maseko.
Thanks, Chair. There is a halfway station that the NCR is already empowered to deal with. It's called compliance notice issuing. The NCR. If there is something that they think is unbecoming and their investigation has confirmed to their own comfort that something is not right, they are able to issue compliance notices to parties. Perhaps this could be imported also if it's not already there. I suspect it's not yet there. Perhaps the tweaking could bring it in there so that, because what that compliance notice does, if the credit provider agrees with it, for instance, then they comply, which means it's immediate and there is no problem. But if they oppose it, it's when then it gets taken up to the tribunal for further deliberation and adjudication evidentially. But they can be able to attack it there and then and say, we force you to comply, and then if then they fight, it's when that compliance notice is challenged. Thanks, Jim.
I think that is a point made, Honourable Williams, and welcome.
Yes, I know I'm not welcome, but it's okay. I've been elected. So you've got no choice. yes, Chair Chow, I'd just like to say I agree with Honourable McPherson with regard to this clause. I think that if there is a mechanism where, as Honourable McPherson said, where we can speedily establish, where it can be speedily established whether or not the loan was reckless, then we'd be, you know, happy with that. Some sort of mechanism where they were only focusing on that particular point. Is this a reckless loan, yes or no? And then it would be then suspended, you know, what I'm saying is we wouldn't need this. But we can't just remove this and just hope that somebody comes up with a mechanism in order to establish that. I think we should, you know, it should be put in our bill somewhere that a mechanism be put in place for this, because it would be terrible, like Honourable McPherson said. I mean, if I was given a reckless loan and it wasn't suspended and I just kept paying, and then eventually after 6 months or a year or whatever it takes, they say, oh, it's reckless, sorry, you don't have to pay anymore. What about all that money I've paid for the, you know, since the beginning? So that's the problem. Thanks, Jim.
Right, I think we can move, Honourable McPherson. I thought there was an element of agreement.
Yeah, and I just want to get some clarity from the advocate. Advocate, I'm just trying to, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm just trying to understand when a consumer goes to the NCR and says, I believe that this loan is reckless. The NCR looks into it and they believe, yes, there is a prima facie case that this is, in fact, reckless. Why, in your opinion, are they not able to say, therefore, based on our investigation, we believe that there is a case to answer and the loan should be suspended until such time it has been adjudicated on? I'm battling to understand the rationale as to why. I mean, you said they can't be the judge and the jury, but they're not the jury because the court is the jury.
All right. I think what we'll do in that case, because you do have a subcommittee meeting, just make a brief comment here because it will. It looks as if there's some form of agreement between the DA and the ANC on the principle. Yes, thank you, Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, G. I was actually saying that there can't be police and the judge. So that is the difference. So what we are doing here is we're saying that they will investigate. So it will be similar to a police officer investigating a murder, arresting a suspect, bringing him to court, and also finding him guilty. So that is a bit of a concern that I have, and I do agree with the concerns raised. I really think that is a problem to make them an adjudicator in respect of the suspension. Because also, I mean, we have an example of a case that the NCR believed prima facie was, and because of the difficulty in how different people calculate affordability, it was not found to be reckless. So
until we have a clear way to determine reckless lending, where it is almost something that you feed into a central computer system and everyone gets the same answer, I think it would be problematic to allow the NCR to make that pre-decision and suspend, because the suspension is a pre-decision, execution of a pre-decision. So that is my concern. But I think the proposal of that there must be some form of mechanism to look at a quick resolution, I think that is perhaps something that we can task the NCR with to consider and to come up with in conjunction with the NCT. And then whatever that mechanism is, that is perhaps what we should rather put into the bill. So if we take away the adjudication function from the NCR, we make it a regulatory function, and you know, even if it is something where we say NCR must do this within so many days, and NCT must consider within so many days. So I think that between the NCR and the NCT is something that they can come up with. The consent, the compliance notice is already one solution if there is agreement. And if there isn't agreement, we still need a measure, in other words.
I do want to close off here, DDG.
Thank you, Chair. We do agree that it is not desirable for the regulator to also be an adjudicator. So the roles must be clear. So this is a role, the adjudication role is the one that the NCT can play. So in terms of the measures to ensure that once reckless lending is picked up, the consumer is protected, is something that we'll look into. However, the roles must be clear. NCR is regulator, NCT is adjudicator. So the confusion must be cleared.
Well, it's always constructive when, you know, both the advocate and the DTI and the NCT sort of see a route ahead, as it were, and agree on that. Thank you. We then move... Oh, Honourable McWilliams, are you now...
Sorry, this is on a completely different matter, Chairperson. Chairperson, I wonder if you could have that laptop removed there because it's obscuring my... there we go, thank you.
Can we move on, please?
Thank you, Chair. I think the next two will be very easy because I think we might have agreement on this. The next two are the technical issues. So the first one, number 23, is this is where I spoke about courts differ on whether you can bring reckless lending to them as a standalone application or whether it must be part of a debt review application. I think that is something that we can fix to make it clear that you can bring it on a standalone application. Added to that, then, of course, the same will apply to the NCT.
Honourable McPherson has just stepped out for a moment in time, but I'm sure you'll keep him posted, Honourable Kachalia. Honourable William?
Chairperson, yes, I agree that we should go in that route. That there is a simple mechanism to make this happen, and we should just do it. Yeah.
Oh, gosh, that's great. Can we move, please?
The next one is also, I think, an easy one. So this is the issue that we were talking about, that debt counsellors can, at this point in time, in terms of the Act, not refer a report of reckless lending to the regulator. So if they do refer to the regulator has to tell them to go to the magistrate for court. So that was a big complaint from debt counsellors, to say, well, you want us to report, but we must go to the magistrate's court because the regulator doesn't take our reports. And the reason for that is that the Act does not allow a report from a debt counsellor to the NCR. It only allows a complaint. I think it's a small technicality. Cannot be the intention, so I think we can fix that.
No, sometimes bills are crafted under pressure and so on. Honourable Williams?
Sorry, I just want some clarity. Are you saying that they will now be able to go to the regulator or, yeah?
Yes, so that they will be able to refer to the regulator as well.
No, thank you very much. Do you want to move on?
I just want to agree on that one, Chairperson.
Yes, I think it's... No, you've made a point. It really is important. This is a bill. and we need to record all our agreements or disagreements. Move on, please, Advocate.
Thank you, Chair. The next one I think is also not going to be too difficult. It is about the credit life insurance that we're making mandatory. The concern that was raised is if we require credit life insurance to be mandatory for a certain group of people, for a certain type of transaction, greater than 6 months, less than 50,000. What if there are no credit life insurance products available? And if that is the case, it means that no one can enter legally into an agreement to borrow less than 50,000 for more than 6 months. So the proposal that I want to make here, because I don't think the issue is with the mandatory, the issue is what if there's no product available? So what I would propose is that we make it very clear in the bill that the commencement dates of different clauses could differ. In other words, one clause could come into operation at a later stage than the others, and so on. Because that will allow the Minister of Trade, Minister of Finance, sit with the FSB, sit with insurers, see what is available, make sure that there is a product in the market that is in accordance with the rates that the Minister will prescribe. And once that is ready, then the clause comes into operation.
Frankly, that we should encourage the insurance people and so on to develop. I mean, they seem to be able to develop these products at the drop of a hat. So we could invite them to come along to us. We'd like them to be proactive here. We're looking for such a product. And there are many, many of these insurance companies that are attached also to banks, etc. So, Honourable Macpherson, we did miss you for a short while, but it was an area that I understand you have no problem with anyway.
Yeah, I think there's a few MPs that are involved in insurance companies, so they might be interested in that opportunity. What I just wanted to say. What I just wanted to say is that I think it's a bit concerning, Advocate, and I know it's not your fault. I think it's the fault of the committees that we haven't engaged the FSB and insurance organisations to actually understand, you know, if this is possible. And I do believe it is possible because, you know, insurance, premiums in this particular market, as far as I understand, you know, are based on volume. Now, you know, if there is volume in this market, I believe that there is an acceptable price, that can be offered on this product. So I think that, Advocate, your suggestion is certainly one worth noting, but I do think to the Honourable Williams that there is a discussion that needs to be had with the industry about what their views or what their thoughts or how they see such a product being priced. But I do think it is something that is important to us going forward to stop this from happening again and to ensure against, you know, some of the, you know, problems in which we're experiencing.
Thank you. In fact, we did engage with the insurance companies when we went to several, I think it is now 8 or 9 meetings with the Standing Committee on Finance, the FSB. We were directly there in action with them, as well as insurance companies, and this was raised there. But I do know you also had an apology on 4 of the occasions for party business. I'm not sure who attended in your place. Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, I was under the impression that this clause would be
would ensure that all credit was supposed to have insurance life attached to it, not just the criteria. When this was put in, we were talking about all credit, not just the less than 7,500 across the board, not just our group. And I don't know if the advocate was aware of that. It was supposed to be for everybody. And then if they're, obviously we'll need to engage with the proposal about the minister being, we put it aside until we've got something for that lower group. But I was under the impression it was for all credit agreements, not just for the poorest of the poor.
And this is why we have these meetings. Honourable MacPherson?
Chair, with respect to the Honourable Williams, I remember it completely different. That it only applied to, advocate, you'd need to help me, I think it was loans more than 6 months or shorter than 6 months, below 50,000, and for people who earned less than 7,500. So it was very specifically targeted to that group so that we don't have to, do this again. So I think maybe the Honourable Williams might have mistaken.
Memories are memories. Now, what I do want to address just on that point for both Honourable MacPherson and Honourable Williams, if you recall, our intention in the bill originally, and I think Honourable Williams, you kept on re-emphasising this, is not simply to address this debt issue that we are addressing, but also to ensure that we encourage savings. We develop a savings culture. That was the other side of the coin. Now, I believe, Honourable Williams and Honourable MacPherson, that the point made now could be, if you like, being proactive. I would agree with you, Honourable MacPherson, that our position was originally very focused on, of course, this particular target group. But having said that, I think the issue is that, is there a reason why we shouldn't encourage all those who enter into such agreements to have insurance? Now, we do know that there are some insurance policies for other forms of credit. We know that. But this is a gap. Honourable MacPherson?
Well, Chair, I mean, it is optional, as I understand, on all insurance, on all credit agreements, as I understand. I think the logic behind this particular point, and it was a point that I had advocated for, is that what we want to do is we want to try and limit these once-off debt sort of scenarios taking place. And so in order to do that, we need to insure against that risk taking place again. And it was on that basis that I said, well, you know, can we not look at a mandatory credit life insurance on unsecured credit in a certain parameter?
I take your point there, but what I would like us to explore, in fact, the government some years back actually took a decision that, and I'm not sure if it was in the first term of the Democratic dispensation that this decision was taken, that all motorists, anyone buying a car, no matter if it was a Scoro or what, would be obliged to take third party. You could not sell a car without that person not having third party. Isn't that correct? That's compulsory, it's mandatory. And the reason they took that decision is because of the accident rate and so on. So it's not unknown, you know, for us, in order to address something, may not insist that all forms. But I do know when I was in finance, the concern was raised by several parties. When you go and buy X, whatever X is, They make you take out another insurance, and I've got life. You know, why must I now take another one out? Or why must I take one that they insist I take out? So I would say that we ought to look at that, but keep in mind what has already been explored by the Standing Committee of Finance over the years, because members of the public were deeply concerned about this issue that I'm not allowed to choose the policy I want. And besides, how many life policies do I need? Is it even allowed to have three or four? So I think let's explore that on the legal side as well. And I know this is not coming from you, Honourable Williams and Honourable Macpherson, but I am asking us to explore the mandatory issue. But I understand, Honourable Macpherson, that would be your view anyway for the target group. Is that correct? And Honourable Williams, would you agree on that? For the target group, it must be mandatory, but we do have a challenge as we sit here that there aren't necessarily insurance packages addressing this. Is that correct? And you have proposed what could be possible. Yes, we engage all of the insurance people and so on, but that clause becomes effective as and when these packages, if I can put it that way, are become available. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just to remind members of what happened, the development, why we got to what we got to. In fact, it is not just for people who earn less than $7,500. It is all loans over 6 months, less than $50,000. And the reason why we limited it like that was that it's quite costly because it is a monthly premium that you pay. So it ended up that you will be, if you buy a car, your car would cost you per month a couple of hundred more. Per month, a couple of hundred rand more per month if you are forced to take out credit life insurance on. So when we have, I think the NCR can maybe give us the current numbers that you're looking at for credit life insurance. So we also brought in a clause that says the minister must, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, determine the rate. But you are still, if you're starting to look at 100,000 or 500,000 or 2 million, it suddenly adds up to quite a lot per month. So the decision was then taken by the committee that, okay, if it is going to add so much to monthly repayments, let us rather than focus, we won't make it to the group earning less than 7,500, but our upper limit was the 50,000 debt. So we said, fine, debts below, up to 50,000 is what we want to target. And then we looked at the period, and a short-term loan, 6 months, the chances of something happening in that 6 months is actually very low, and by the time it happens, you've probably repaid most of it in any event. So we made it more than 6 months. So that was the rationale for the longer than 6 months and to limit it at 50,000.
Do we all get the understanding there? Not saying you agree, but do we understand, right? Okay, we should move on then.
Chair, the next one that we... So the bill required a credit life insurance to be taken out. Oh, there's one thing that I just wanted to jump back on, the consultation with insurance companies. In fact, when I presented, Chair, there was a decision actually made by this committee that there must be some engagement. Because one of the problems with credit life insurance is that if you fall into arrears, your credit life insurance lapses. And I do not have a legal solution for that. I don't have a legal solution for that. It is something that will have to be addressed via the FSB. But it will definitely be something for this committee to engage in. So the decision was already taken that there must be engagement. So I did not bring that issue up again in this policy decision, because it's not a policy decision that this committee can take. When the committee discussed that concern of this thing lapsing, because what has been the purpose? I mean, that is exactly why you have the credit life insurance, that there would be further discussion.
May I suggest we do seek further legal advice on that specific area? I think that would be wise. Do we agree? Yes. All right, let's move on.
Okay. Then something that we did not say in our bill, because we just say credit life insurance, is what type of risk should be insured against. Now, I do not have the answer there. And perhaps this is something that Treasury can advise the committee on, or even DTI, or the regulator itself. Because what is it that we want to cover? The thing is, the more risks that there are, that affects your likelihood, and that affects the price. If there's less risks, that also then changes the calculation of the premium. So are we trying to guard against disability, retrenchment, death? What are the things? I don't think this is a question that has to be answered now, unless DTI, NCR, I don't know if Treasury is here, has some proposals in that regard. If they don't have proposals, it is something that we can park because it's a quick insertion into the bill.
Fine, thank you. Mr. Kumkani?
Thanks, Chair. In terms of the credit life insurance regulations, the issues that are supposed to be covered for a credit life insurance product, it's your retrenchment for loss of employment or whatever the case may be, it's death or incapacity, or if you are not if you get injured during the course of your work, you can't actually be in a position to work anymore. And the issue of risk, it's risk in relation to the likelihood of that happening, and also the risk of the debt not being able to be paid at a later stage. So all that, we had made sure that it's covered within the capped amount of 450. Mm-hmm. So the likelihood of a premium going beyond 450, something else must actually be produced. Like if there's an innovative product that the insurance company has, in order to ensure that you get covered for it, they can add an extra 1 rand. That is in the regulations as implemented last year in August. So it can be beyond that. That's what I wanted to emphasize.
No, thank you for that point. Much appreciated. Do we then move on then? Thank you.
The next points are not on the document that was handed out. It is something, it's on the screen, I've added on the screen, and it's not edited. It comes straight from an email that was sent from Treasury. And the reason I wasn't sure if I should bring it up, but I know that there was also concerns raised in the committee about, you know, do we have the 7,500 group clearly defined or do we not? What does it mean? What Treasury was asking, and I think it is a valid point, it is something that we need to make clear in the bill, is your 7,500, are we, sorry, she asked it very, very strangely.
Please hold there for a minute because I can't be disturbed while something is, you are on the mic. That advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. The first question that they're asking, I'll summarize it because it is a bit rambling. The question is, should a person who earned 10 or 20,000 or 30 or 50,000 per month and who is then retrenched, and in other words, because they're retrenched, they earn less than 7,500 per month, should that person qualify for the debt intervention measure? I understood that that would be the case because it is at the time that you apply And we would say for the past, I think we say an average for the past 3 months or something like that. So in other words, you would have had to be retrenched for 3 months, and in those 3 months you haven't found another job, and then you would be able to apply. Because the problem is, even a person who earned 20 or 30,000 rand a month, if they don't have a job, they become part of the group that could be poor. So that is how I understood that question. Okay, the second one relates to the 50,000. So let's maybe first look at the 7,500. Do we understand that at the time of the application, that is your income?
Right, I think so, but let's hear from the subcommittee, Honourable Williams.
Definitely, sir, Chairperson, because that's how it should be. I mean, because there is a process, remember. Like I said before, it's not like you apply and tomorrow your debt's going to be written off. So if you qualify at the time of after the bills, if you qualify, then you qualify. Because, you know, if they find out that you can actually afford to pay back, they'll find out during the process. It's not a quick thing. Getting debt extinguished will take months. It's not going to be a quick process. We need to start telling the people of South Africa that this is not going to happen overnight. Even after you've applied, it takes time. This, you know.
Hope they don't think it's like a fire with the extinguisher, and you address it within a minute. So we'll have to point that one out. Did you want to share that with us, Honourable William?
Even I'm getting emails from members of the public saying, "Yeah, I read this article in the Sunday Times. Is it true?" And I said yes. And they sort of said, "Great, this is wonderful. We can't wait." And I'm concerned that this moral hazard that the advocate speaks about is starting to set in already, where people are going, "Well, you know, this is what's coming on the horizon. You know, do I need to pay?" So it's a very tricky issue.
Well, I think it's up to these credit providers to effectively check affordability, which they are not doing in every case. Honourable Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. The next comments relate to the 50,000 and whether that 50,000 is the capital amount. Do we, in other words, not take fees and charges into account, or does it include interest and charges? What Treasury is saying that it's very easy for a small debt obligation to become huge, and then you would be disqualified. But in fact, you just entered into maybe 30 or 40,000 worth of debt.
Honourable William?
Chairperson, I think that the intention is the amount that you've borrowed. So if you've borrowed 49 or 50,000 rand, and then of course it's going to escalate because of the way it is, but it's the amount that you've borrowed. So that's the what we're talking about, the 50,000, not a 50,000 rand loan, and it's now escalated to 65,000 and now it's become, you know, that doesn't work, no.
That was the intention then, right?
And those are the big issues. So then we move on to the other decisions.
I see what was 27 here is now 29. All right? That's right. Yes.
I suppose I can quickly fix that. But okay, so
Chairperson, if the numbers have changed now and we don't have 20, those other two, then our numbers will always be wrong and we'll be keep asking, where are we on the presentation?
Proposing, I mean, on the Seabritz is not here at the moment, but can we renumber? That's why I said it's 27, 29. And we just renumber for the moment. However, we will get the updated one by Monday, I imagine, or Tuesday. All right? But you've got a point there, Honourable Williams. Can we all just renumber 27? decisions. Is that right?
27? I don't think there's really a decision to be taken by the committee. There were requests for definitions to be included. And the proposal that I'm making is to say, look, when we go through the bill we draft, if we see there's a need for a definition, we can include it.
Smooth.
The next one, 28, is about incidental credit agreements. Now, there was a concern that the Act has limited application to incidental credit agreements. Now, what is an incidental credit agreement? Just so that we remind ourselves, I buy a dress from a dressmaker. It's a cash transaction. I pitch up at the boutique. I'm going to take this dress home. She says to me, look, the beads that I had to put on costed a little bit more. So you need the new price for this is going to be 100 rand more. I say, oh, I don't have that 100 with me. I'll come back and pay you in a week's time. I don't arrive in a week's time. I don't arrive in 2 weeks' time. She sends me an invoice. She says, look, you still owe me 200 rand, as we've agreed, because of those beads. So that 200 rand then becomes an incidental credit agreement. So it was never intended to be a credit agreement. She didn't do an affordability assessment. It was a cash transaction. I agreed about the amount. I was going to come and pay it, but I then did not pay it. So that is where that's just one example. I suppose there would be other examples, but so we would agree that I would pay in 5 days, whatever. That doesn't make it a credit agreement. I think it results in credit because now I am late with my cash payment. Now, those agreements are included. You don't have to do an affordability assessment because it wasn't the intention for it to be a credit agreement. But there are a number of other things that do apply. And in fact, the one thing that I've confirmed does apply is debt review. So when you do undergo debt review, your incidental credit agreements will be applicable. Because of that, I am of the view that it actually should be included in this measure as well. The concerns that were raised that incidental credit agreements aren't intended to be credit agreements and therefore it should be excluded, I think does not hold water if it is also included in debt review, because then it is clearly seen as something that is part of your expenses and so on.
Do we agree? Honourable
McPherson? One of the things that have bothered me about this bill is the inability to deal with unscrupulous lenders, and so this has raised my attention insofar as would we not be able to include those agreements that are made outside of the NCA, so between a loan shark, a machinist, and if someone could come to the NCO and say, look, I've been loaned this money, I cannot afford it. It was done outside of the prescripts of affordability assessments, so they're not registered with the NCR, and I cannot afford to pay this back. Can an order be made on an agreement, even though it is not legally binding between the loan shark and the consumer?
Honourable McPherson, did you want to come in there, Honourable Williams? No. A view that I have is Mashanisi was illegal. It's an illegal thing. And therefore, it being illegal, there's no ways you can enforce the debt in any way. But it may be something we need to look at to say that people who do have dealings with such people should be able to give us their names. Of course they won't, because their lives may be at risk. I've been threatened by one of them and I didn't owe them any money, but merely because I told one of their clients not to pay a cent more. And they had the nerve to come straight into the constituency office with a gun. But I said to him, look, I've already faced a firing squad, get out.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, the The unscrupulous lenders, definitely, it's an unlawful agreement, and there are methods in the Act how to deal with them. The problem is, like you say, that they aren't reported because of reasons with that. Okay, so incidental credit agreements will include. There was a question about we are not making the measure available to corporates, so you must be a natural person. But the question was, then, should Stockfels, trusts, and sole proprietors be excluded? Now, first, Stockfel is specifically excluded from the definition of juristic person in the Act. So there was a reason why Stockfel is seen as a natural person by the Act, in other words. A trust is already included, so we don't have to worry about that. A sole proprietor is a person who does business in their own name. They might call it something, but it is very tightly connected to their own personal finances. So I think it would be very difficult to distinguish their personal finances from their business finances, because it will normally be a very small business, someone who maybe does, to continue with the dress example, someone who does some sewing at home. She might have a sewing machine, and they make a dress or two, and that is what they sell, and that is a sole proprietor then. So I would not think that they should be excluded. I think that is part of their personal income that it is who they are. But maybe DTI can indicate to us what is the reason for Stockfel. What is the concern around Stockfel? Why wasn't it a juristic person? Is it something that qualifies for debt review, so that we can maybe make a specific decision on whether Stockfel should be able to qualify for this?
Let's hear from DTI. Do you want to speak, DDG, Ms. Masocha?
Thank you, Chair. I think my colleagues will assist in this area. It's one of those areas we may need to look into, like outside the forum. However, from my understanding, Stockfels are a kind of a formation. It's a group of individuals, but they come together in a formation, so which means that they are an organized sort of entity of some sort, which then takes them outside the scope of a natural person. So they have a form, maybe they are 10, they meet for a purpose. It's something like a cooperative of some sort. So it's some kind of an establishment. So it's not a natural person. But my colleagues will assist in terms of clarifying further.
Right. Do you wish to assist before the rest of DTI? Do you think, right, Mr. Masharpa?
Thank you, Chair. I think the other reason was if there are any transactions in the Stockfel, they will be at arm's length. In other words, if you borrow money, you are a member of the Stockfel. You borrow money from the Stockfel, they wouldn't charge you interest and other charges. But as the DDG say, maybe it's something that we will need to look at in the total review of the Act.
Right, so we hear that as well. I wasn't aware any Stockfels charged you interest. I'd be interested to learn which ones they are. Because all the ones I know about who operate from parks and houses, people's homes, they don't charge interest. Right, Mr. Kumkani?
Chair, I don't have much to add except to say that if this issue can be handed over to DTI to have a look at it, and then we will provide the committee with a very comprehensive response.
So we'll flag it. Shall we flag it? Honourable William?
Chairperson, I don't know if we should flag this, and because it's quite a big, we shouldn't include Stockfels into this. I don't believe, like we said, because they're not an individual. It's a group of people who got together voluntary, and they basically lend money to each other voluntary in an agreement between themselves. And I think that it would be quite a long process to find out how, and I don't, it would stall the bill, in fact. So I don't think we should include them. And if there is a mechanism later to include Stockfels, then perhaps we can come up with an amendment at a later stage. But I don't think that we should, because it is such a huge issue, this. You know, there are millions of people, you know, in South Africa who belong to Stockfels, so potentially this could derail the whole bill if we wait for that answer from DTI. Thank you.
No, there appears to be some agreement here. So, Professor Maseko?
Thanks, Chair. Yes, I think I was going to support what Honourable Williams is saying, because the stock funds are some kind of a bank, a self-bank, a bank that borrows to its own members. And so it's more corporate, really, than individuals. It's not even like a partnership who are people coming together, but once they operate as a group. Now, they are even exempted if they join this association of stock firms in the country by the Reserve Bank from getting regulated or getting a license for banking or for credit providing if they are part of that association, and provided they don't lend to anybody outside their formation. So they are definitely more of a corporate entity. Thanks.
What puzzled me, in view of what you explained, Advocate van der Merwe, the sole proprietor, you know, I see here it says, should Stockfels trusts and sole proprietors be excluded? And I understood you to be wanting to persuade us to actually not exclude sole proprietors. And we haven't commented on that. We've commented only on the Stockfels. Can we comment on that, Honourable Williams? And Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Kachalia?
Jefferson, I think that it's financial service providers that are registered financial that qualify. That's what we're talking about, right? That is correct. So I'm not sure about sole proprietors. I don't know how they would be. I think they should be excluded. You know, I don't think that we should go down to that level. You see, the question is, what are they being excluded? How are they included is the question I want to know for that. How are the sole proprietors included?
Right. Just one moment, Mr. Kumkani.
Thanks, Chair. Just to clarify something, I think I would like to agree with Honourable Williams that sole proprietors should be excluded based on the fact that these are all defined as forms of business entities under the Companies Act. So I thought that this particular bill is focusing on consumers, so to speak. Thank you.
No, I think that's a good idea. If you embark on... Oh, sorry, Honourable MacPherson.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we also assume that Stockfels are sort of low income, sort of a couple of hundred rand here and there. And that's why, you know, I'm not sure how Stockfels can be included. Because there's vast amounts of money in some of these Stockfels. So I don't see the reason why it should be included. Because they are also have a business nature to what they do. So even though they might not be defined as such, the nature is still that of a business.
Well, this is why I suggested earlier that we flag it, because I do think we need some more input here. On Professor Maseko?
Thanks, Chair. I was actually on the next one that we were almost stepping into, the one of sole proprietors.
Look at the sole proprietors.
Yes, I was of the view that sole proprietors can exist at many levels. You will find somebody who is running a car servicing business as a sole proprietor, but you will also find that hawker who is selling tomatoes, styling them as Auntie Evelyn's Spaza shop or something like that. It's a business when you look at it, but it's really just an individual trying to make a living and trying to start up and generate some kind of a business. So my suggestion to the committee would be that we include sole proprietors, but perhaps then just rather limit maybe with turnover annually as to how far up can you go, so that at a certain level then they no longer qualify, but they are all individuals.
Okay.
Thanks, Chair.
All right. I think we will bring that point back because it does sound quite reasonable, but I also want to suggest that we don't just agree with everything on the Stockvelds and the trusts at the moment, but that we explore it further. And then we take forward the point that the professor has made about possibly, you know, trying to put a cap on this, that if you're over that cap, well, you know, you qualify as whatever. Perhaps that point could be looked at, Advocate van der Merwe. Let's move.
Thank you, Chair. Can may I just answer the question? I think the NCT has answered it, but why the Honourable Williams asked how are they included? And the reason for that is that they are, in fact, not a juristic person in terms of the Companies Act. They're a natural person. So, So that is why they were included. And already they will be limited because the income of the sole proprietor will be the 7,500 limit. So in other words, and that is why I was suggesting that it be included, because the salary that the person draws is the income of the business. It is so intertwined. But fine, we will come back in any event, look at all of those things. The next one is number 30, clause 12. Should the court give the consumer an option to participate in the debt intervention measure and be able to grant the debt intervention measure? What happened here is that in clause 12, because we're excluding any matter that is already before a court, so that the court process can take their course, we said that a court can refer that matter to the NCR to be part of the debt intervention process. It was pointed out to us that in the National Credit Regulator versus ShopRite Investments, the court actually indicated that a consumer may not wish to participate in debt review because of the reputational consequences, and they have a right not to participate. So I must admit, I did not think of the fact that a consumer might not want to participate. And I think I would recommend that we do give them an option. In other words, the court gives them an option. Do you want to? I see that you might qualify. Do you want to? And then another proposal was made, but if this matter is already before the court and the court is already looking at this person's income, et cetera, why can't the court just not make the decision? Why must it go through the whole process and be delayed? I'm not sure that the court will necessarily in all cases have the necessary facts before them, but if it is, for instance, a debt review application, then the court will have all the facts before them, and they might say, but look, this is rather a debt intervention matter. And in that case, I don't see why it would be impossible for the court to make the actual order there and then, instead of referring it to the tribunal to go through the whole process. I think it will be in very limited cases where the court will have sufficient facts to actually make the order, but I do not see anything wrong in law from allowing the court to make the order if they can make it. So those are just the two questions. Shall we give a discretion, and shall we allow the court to make the order if they can?
Thank you very much, Advocate van der Merwe. I wonder if we can then move on. Thank you.
The next one deals with clause 14 and rehabilitation. And I actually just want to give us an idea of what we are currently saying about it. If you would just bear with me for one moment, I just want to page there. So 88E in the bill deals with rehabilitation. So what the bill currently provides is that the debt intervention applicant must fulfill the obligations that were due on the date of the application for debt intervention. Now, to me, that means the obligations that were due on the date of application would be your capital, your cost, your interest, whatever that were due on the date of the application. In other words, everything that was considered must be paid in full. And the question that came up is how will you calculate what is the outstanding debt, And I actually don't think that there is a question. I had to bring it because it was quite a big issue raised by credit providers about having to repay everything. And I got the impression that they almost felt that everything that must be repaid is as if there was no debt intervention. In other words, as if interest had kept on running, as if costs had kept on running. And I do not think that was the intention of the committee. I think the intention of the committee is, if you can pay off everything that you owed on the date of the application, then we will give you this rehabilitation relief.
On this, unless what you're looking at is precisely the point that Advocate van der Merwe is making.
That is actually just the question. So do we only require them to pay in full what was due on the date of the application, or what would have been incurred if the application did not happen?
All right, let's put that to the committee in the first instance, Honourable Williams, followed by the Honourable McPherson.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure what we do here. We need more discussion on this because of the implications. In other words, then what we're saying is, if you go through the debt review process and you've found that, no, you must pay everything, then all of that accumulated interest will now start hitting you. You know, it'll be almost a disadvantage to apply, which might be a good thing, which will reduce the amount of people applying, but also it could disadvantage some people who have legitimately applied because they legitimately thought that they couldn't, you know, that they qualified and they couldn't pay back their debt. So it's a little, I don't know, what are the implications to somebody applying? Let's say they're applying for 50,000 Rand debt review, and at the end of the process, which could be going on for, well, it could go on for quite a long time, they get told, no, you haven't qualified for your debt to be extinguished or suspended or anything. Now, are they expected now to pay the lump sum of all of that interest? You know, it's quite an expensive exercise for them. But you can also, I do understand the credit provider's position here, is because everybody could apply. And just to be stuck without paying that amount of money, so you could get all 18 million people or 9 million of the people that, you know, that 80-20 told us, whatever that number is, I think it's 9 million qualified. They could all apply, and then they could just sit and not pay any debt back for the period that it took and all get told no. So I'm a little bit concerned about the legitimate applications. How are we going to deal I don't know, Chairperson, to
yes,
be honest.
Look, we've had a lot of discussion on this, but it needs more. Honourable McPherson?
I mean, I just think that the Honourable Williams' point is well made because, I mean, we know that this is, at best, a three-year process. That's what the NCR has told us. So I really think that this is something that the subcommittee needs to deliberate on, and I'd second the Honourable Williams' position for that to take place.
Right, so we are agreeing that we need to flag it, that we need a lot more engagement to learn a bit more about it because it is a very real challenge. There are those who will exploit this, definitely. And on the other hand, there are those who should get it and may perhaps not wish now to take advantage of it. Honourable William.
Chairperson, perhaps there should be a clause around this issue that says if the National Credit Regulator or allowing the National Credit Regulator to rule that this application was put in with the intention of benefiting from the gap in the repayment, perhaps so that it deals with individuals who are attempting to just not pay their money for the three-year period or whatever it is. Do you know what I'm saying? So we could have a clause in the bill that says that the National Credit Regulator or the National Credit Tribunal, one of the two, must assess whether or not this is a legitimate request. But I don't know how they're going to do that. They must come in and talk to us exactly how they think. The The tribunal should perhaps come to us now and tell us how they think we should go around this.
I think we could ask Professor Maseko to just give us the advantage of his mind.
Chair, thanks. It's a bit of a deep end for us because we are not talking about something that's already existing. We're crafting a bill that is still to be born, to become law. But just in thinking, I think it is much cleaner when the amount that was frozen gets frozen in time, so that when you say we're reviving it, you revive that which was frozen, that you don't work out anything in between that will be arbitrary and cause you problems and so on.
One view and an opinion here that we need to take into consideration. Honourable MacPherson's hand first, Honourable Williams.
Yeah, Chair, we know that people are watching these proceedings. And I would hate for that sort of view, Professor, with respect to sort of be out there in the public, because I don't think that could be possible, that the debt amount is simply frozen until such time as it is sort of, adjudicated on. Because the Honourable Williams's point was, if you had 9 million people make applications, I mean, you crash the credit market in one foul swoop because you freeze 9 million. So, I mean, I don't think, with respect, Professor, it's as simplistic as that. I think that it's a very complicated issue. And thank you, Advocate, for bringing it to our attention, because I certainly haven't thought down that line. So it's a complicated issue, and it's going to have to be treated with a lot of well-made thought and research, I think.
One must take it soberly. Honourable Williams, then I will take the DDG Masocha after you.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, so that is the situation, because the situation I'm saying is exactly that. If 9 million people apply to have 50,000 Rand debt extinguished, and during that whole up to three-year period, at the end of that three-year period, all of that debt had been frozen for that three-year period or two-year period, and then at the end, all 9 million were rejected. I mean, the credit providers would be out of all of that money for no apparent reason at all, and Honourable MacPherson is right. Although I might not be on the side of the banks, I'm definitely not on the side of them collapsing. Thank you, Chair.
That's why I say, the intention of the committee is not to collapse the banks, not to bring down the credit market, etc., not at all, but rather to craft some piece of legislation in which we can assist the most vulnerable members of the community, the poor, and those who perhaps through no fault of their own have wound up in the sorry situation, death, retrenchment, etc. So what is happening here, for anyone who may be listening, is not a carte blanche, a blank check for you to go out and spend. You may find yourself spending harshly, and you'll lose everything then. Yes, Professor?
Thanks, Chair. I think there may be a bit of a disconnect there. The question I was trying to respond to is the one you asked, not a general one. So when I'm talking about freezing or frozen in time, I was talking about whether the interest when you rehabilitate should be running even during the suspension or the extinguishing. So I was talking only about whether the interest should be the one that was already owing at the time when this was suspended or when this was extinguished. Not to just freeze all debts or,
I understood you to
mean
interest.
Answer, yes.
We did. But as I said, it's not a decision that's been taken now, but rather a discussion. Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I actually do think that we have a bit of a confusion. The question was about rehabilitation itself. So I actually can't take credit for the question. It is a very good question, though, because it made me suddenly scramble and have to look at a number of things. I'll come back to the question of rehabilitation. I think this question we need to first quickly address. What we had
in the bill as it stands now is when a person applies, they are not allowed to enter into any further credit agreements. But conversely, the credit provider could no longer harass them. In other words, could not call for payment, could not institute judicial proceedings. But interest, cost, fees kept running up until the time of adjudication. So if adjudication was rejected, there would still have been all the interest, all the fees. So that is what we have in the bill at the moment. From the discussions in the subcommittee, if we are going to follow the debt review process as an example, then it applies even more so. So interest, costs, everything will continue to run. Of course, the officials in the NCR will now start negotiating about the costs. That's the wrong way to put it. The system that they will put into place will result in a negotiation of the interest costs being reduced, etc. But the consumer will still be expected to pay if that negotiation process achieves a kind of a resolution. So it says, if the system indicates, okay, you will have to pay 1,000 rand per month, that will go to 5 creditors. Then already at that stage, even before the tribunal's order, the consumer will start paying that in a show of good faith. So I think we are sorted. I think we are sorted. But I think it was a very good question because I was suddenly also a bit panicky about that. The question that I was asking is, if a person successfully received suspension or extinguishing, and they're now in a period, either in the period of suspension or it is extinguished, and they're in that period where they cannot apply for credit, and they want to rehabilitate themselves, they want to take an action to rehabilitate, they don't want to wait for the 2-year period, then they can go to their credit providers. Let's say, for instance, that it was a person who was retrenched. The person applied because there was just no prospect. Then in the second year of suspension, the person gets a CEO job, earns millions, and wants to lift themselves up out of this situation. Then they go to all their credit providers and pay them what was due on the date of application. The same would apply if it was extinguished. They go back, they pay everything that was extinguished. That in itself has a bit of a legal concern, but we'll also just have to think about that when it comes. That is a legal technical thing that we need to sort out as drafters. Do not worry about that. So they go back and they pay. Then they come back to the tribunal and they say, look, we have made good on all our debt as it was on the date of application. Please give an order that we are now rehabilitated and that we can enter the, or that I was rehabilitated and I can enter into the credit market again. So that was the rehabilitation question. So the question that then was asked is, but should this person who wants to make good and wants to get himself or herself out of this limited credit period faster, should they repay as on the date of the application, or should they repay, I suppose we could even ask the question, as on the date of the order, or should they repay as if there was never an order? In other words, as if interest and costs kept running. So that was the question about rehabilitation. Yeah.
I think it would be useful if those various options then are just listed for us, because we will be coming back to this point. All right, I hope everyone understands that. Now, what we are going to be doing is to be breaking for tea for 10 minutes. Thank you. I believe the tea is outside and some few odd open sandwiches are here. My watch says 20 to 10. We'll adjourn. We'll come back at 10 to 10. Thank you. Well, we've got the NCT, the NCR. No, we don't have them at all. They just disappeared. Anyway, we'll have to start without the NCR. Right. Where were where we advocate van der Merwe? Yeah.
Okay.
Clause 14 under rehabilitation. We move to the next part of clause 14, right?
The next one, Treasury indicated that there could be financial literacy and budget training already being developed. I have asked them to give me that information. They have not yet, but I have alerted them again that we need to know what is being developed, because if there is something that is developed, then it can become mandatory. We couldn't make it mandatory because there isn't something in place. But if there is something in place, then we can. But I'm still waiting for Treasury to confirm.
Yes, Honourable William.
Chairperson, can we not deal with this the same way that we're dealing with that clause about the I've forgotten the clause now. The one that we're gonna put on the credit one that we're putting on hold until there's a product. So surely we can deal with this in the same manner.
I think it's a good idea, Honourable McPherson.
Yeah, I mean, I've said from the outset on this bill, it is a self-defeating bill unless it changes habits. If it reinforces current behaviour, then we have a problem on our hands. Now, the issue of training and what is available, sort of the NCR, and I thought it was actually quite problematic, the answer that they gave DDG when they sort of wrung their hands and said, well, you know, we don't really have anything in place. I mean, the NCR is not just a regulator, but it is supposed to be there to assist consumers in I believe, in changing, you know, the behavior. It's something that they've never thought of before. It's something that they don't have in place to this point. And I think that that's a big problem, and I think it's something that you need to arrest. But the problem is that, advocate, for how long do we go down the road, you know, instituting debt relief with no educational literacy on changing behavior? Because the problem is, Chair, is that once those people have received their debt intervention and that debt has been extinguished, and they do not have the budgetary training there and then, that horse is bolted, long gone. And so I'm concerned the first round of recipients of debt intervention may very well not receive any assistance or training whatsoever. So I need us to understand, advocate, you know, like Honourable Williams has suggested, you know, sort of dealing it with in the same manner of the credit life insurance, you're sort of outsourcing that to a later date with the minister. I'm not sure that this can be outsourced to a later date. I think that when this bill is ready to go to the House, I need to know what that program of literacy and budgetary training will be.
There is, during the course of our public hearings, when we invited various people to come and address the committee, make submissions, the banks were very much part of that. And in fact, BASA was here. And they actually handed out, either last year or the year before, packages that they have developed, which I did take advantage of reading and going through, very solid packages that had been developed jointly, as it were, by the banks, you know, the BASA. So there are some, and I don't think they are going to put, as it were, a kind of copyright that would seal them from others using it. That's one issue. And I imagine that the National Credit Regulator with DTI and the NCT may well be able to develop yet another such package, you see. So I do believe that, you know, these packages, we can get them off the ground, and that people who make credit available for whatever purpose, should be made aware of that and that they can make use of it. But if I recall, one of the issues members wanted was for it to be obligatory, you know, once you've got yourself into debt for whatever the reason, then part of getting straight, as it were, and us bringing you back on the road, you would have to undergo this financial training, as it were, literacy. Yes, Honourable William?
Chairperson, and I think it should be made clear, like you said, that it's not just financial training or literacy to be given to the people who's had their debts extinguished, but anybody who's applied. It should be for everybody who applies, and hopefully they can extend it to the whole country, but, you know, initially it's for everybody who's applied for the debt relief program.
No, I think that's been made very clear, and let's keep it that way. I'm sure we can move, though. Advocate Vandermeer.
Thank you, Chair. If I could just maybe respond to one thing. With the way that the debt measure, with some of the things that we've discussed in the subcommittee, indicated that our debt intervention measure will not be able to be operational immediately. There will be a period before the Act comes into operation. Now, that could actually be the time needed to develop something. So perhaps we do not need to specifically say that that clause can be made operational at a later stage, because the whole Act will be made operational once the systems are in place in the NCR. In other words, once they have the people who can do the debt intervention similar to the debt review, once the systems are there, and that period will be a couple of months in any event. So there's nothing that stops this committee from saying, well, we'll make it mandatory. We accept that the Act is not going to be operational immediately. When you bring the Act into operation for the debt intervention to start, you also need to have systems in place to do literacy and that kind of training.
Well, silence means agreement. Let's move.
Apologies, Jay. The next question is 33. It goes to both clauses 15 and 16. Is whether the power to declare credit agreements unlawful in terms of Section 89 of the Act should be reserved for courts. I think the tribunal should advise the committee. My view is that a tribunal is a form of judicial entity, and I do not see any reason why the entity cannot do it, but perhaps the tribunal has some reservations themselves.
Thank you. Professor Maseko.
Thanks, Chair. I will perhaps just describe for the committee's benefit what is currently obtaining. The tribunal has got to deal with prohibited conduct, which is unlawful in itself when it occurs. And it also has to deal with required conduct that has not been adhered to. That also is unlawful, because anything that contravenes the Act as it provides now is unlawful. So the unlawful term to me means that it can be declared, it can be found, because already when we find against prohibited conduct or uncomplied with required conduct, we are already finding against unlawfulness. The only difference being that if that position is against an infraction that is criminalized in the Act, we cannot pronounce criminal sentences. So that person would have to be sentenced in a magistrate's court, because they deal with crime. But what happens even in civil matters, we find against some entity, and if there is a civil claim arising out of our finding, we issue a certificate confirming that prohibited conduct has been committed by entity so-and-so, and the claimant is able to take that to the civil court to then enforce that. So the finding can be done because it's already being done, whether civil or criminal, but it's the enforcement of the sanction that the tribunal cannot do, but it can certify it for those courts that are then empowered to do so, whether it be civil or criminal. I hope that assists the committee.
Thank you very much. Right, let's move.
Thank you, Chair. Then the last issue, 34, deals with the last issues, 34 and 35, apologize, my number there wrong, deal with offences and penalties. And although I have them separate, I would like us to consider them at the same time. And in terms of the offences and penalties table that follows after number 35. If I could just explain, some of the concerns that were raised were, first off, whether these things should be criminalized. Shouldn't this just be an administrative fine that is given? Why is the committee bringing criminal offenses into a civil act? So I think if we look at them each by themselves, we look at that what is currently the penalty, and then we can see whether that is sufficient or whether it should in fact be a crime. The penalty itself is 10 years or an equivalent fine, or if it is a company, 10% of annual turnover, or I think 1 million, whichever is the greater amount. And Justice was of the view that this could be quite harsh if you think about, especially in respect of some of the offences, if you think about if a person holds himself out as a legal practitioner, the penalty for that contravention is only 2 years, not 10 years. But I think that for the committee, it would be best to look at each action, consider whether that action should be a crime, and if it should be a crime, what the current penalty is, and if the current penalty is, if the penalty of 10 years is too harsh. So if we could start with the first offence, 157A, the new section 157A, this deals with the debt intervention. So if a consumer submits false information or information intending to mislead the NCR or the NCT, that is a crime in terms of the bill. Or if a consumer deliberately alters their financial circumstances in order to qualify for the debt intervention. I'm married out of community of property, so I quickly transfer all my assets into my husband's name. Then I qualify because I only earn $7,500. There's nothing that can be used to pay the debt, etc. Or I owe something and then my husband maybe pays a certain amount off so that I have $50,000 debt maximum. So that kind of deliberately altering is currently a crime. So I think the first question is whether these things should be a crime, should it be an offence to do so? And then the second question is this serious enough that we feel that a person should be able to go to prison for 10 years if it was a very... Remember that 10 years is the maximum, so the court could give 2 months, 3 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years. But if this person was the worst case scenario, in other words, would that justify 10 years?
Thank you very much. Oh, gosh, I didn't see whose hand was up first. So was Honourable Williams. Yes, well, now, I hope that's not intentionally fraudulent, as they say. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think that we should reduce the 10-year sentence to a 2-year period. I also think that the others are fine when it says that if you deliberately alter your financial circumstances and the proposed penalty is a permanent prohibition, you're permanently prohibited from accessing debt interventions. I think that that's also fine. But perhaps after we've received the information that if you pretend to be a lawyer, you only get 2 years, But if you, you know, submit false information in order to write off 50,000 rand, you could get 10 years. I think 10 years is a bit harsh. So I think it should be reduced to 2 years, that maximum penalty. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Matthew.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because, I mean, if you're applying, I'm not too sure that sort of many people with sort of a home loan are going to be applying for debt intervention. But, I mean, if you're applying, I mean, theoretically, you sort of, you know, in a very tough, bad place, you know, maybe don't have a job, you've been retrenched, you have no income. I'm just, you know, how do you square trying to impose a fine on someone who has no money? That doesn't make sense. So I'm just a thought about, you know, how do you find someone who has nothing, even though that they are, you know, trying to mislead you. And also the permanent prohibition or prohibition on applying for a debt intervention. Does that not apply, advocate, or should that not apply as an option for both? Because if you are, you know, intending to submit or mislead the NCR or an NCT, I would think that would be an option of a penalty, because, you know, to mislead any entity, you know, and also a state entity, I think is quite a serious offence, and I think that all mitigating, you know, opportunities to avoid the moral hazard need to be in place, and the only way to avoid the moral hazard is to make, you know, strict, you know, penalties so that people know that you can't, you know, play around with this process. So I don't know if it's an opportunity to extend the permanent prohibition to both the offences.
You know what worries me about your statement on how do you fine or whatever somebody who has no money. Well, I can't see such a person then lying. He's actually, or she's actually, applying for debt because they have no money. So, you see, I'm trying to figure out when they could find themselves in that difficulty. Because they are a genuine case and they are going to get this help. So I can understand if what you may agree with is to say, well, it's not that somebody doesn't have any money, but that somebody who does have some money, but not that much, then proceeds to give the wrong information. But they would qualify, remember, if they had no money at all, no wherewithal. So I can't see why they would even lie or misrepresent themselves. Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, I'd like to know, this is just for information, is there currently a fine or imprisonment if I were to lie on my application for credit? I'm talking about me as an MP, with my huge salary and my massive, you know, quality lifestyle that I have, if I were to lie on my application for credit, what would happen to me if I was caught doing that? You know, because surely there must be some, if there's nothing there, then I think that we mustn't try and take away any penalty if you, you know, submit wrong information in your debt extinguishing application. But I'm just trying to work out if, you know, somebody who can afford to get a loan, if they lie, what happens on their application? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable McPherson.
What I meant by that, Chair, is that, you know, I mean, I think that we're going to be, you know, dealing with maybe people that aren't even in the, you know, formal economy. You know, that they sort of have a salary because, you know, they work 2 days here, 1 day there, there's no payslip, you know, that sort of thing like that. And they may very well come to the tribunal and say, you know, I earn this. And a credit provider may actually say, well, you know, we've actually totaled this, this, and this, and, you know, you actually earn, you know, Y. And the credit and the tribunal will say, well, you know, you're misleading us. And it may be a genuine, honest, you know, mistake. Or they may not even, in fact, be aware of a credit agreement that they have. You know, these things happen. And that's why I'm just saying that I think we need to think carefully about the offences. We don't want to make them too lenient, but we also don't want to put someone in more debt by saying, well, here's a fine. You can't even pay your first debt. Here's a 10,000 rand fine. The guy says, why, how am I even supposed to pay, you know, this fine? So I just think we need to give some thought to, about it, because what we may view as intentionally misleading may actually be an honest mistake. And that's where I think that the grey area may exist.
I think there is a way of getting around that. All MPs are commissioners of oath, as you know. Now, I'm sure when someone says to you, can you please do X, and you're in your constituency office, you actually say, you know, you have said this. Is this correct? Because this is like going to court now, because you're going to swear that it is. And if it's not correct, that could be a serious problem for you. So you explain what it is they are actually saying is correct. They've written it, but they may have been a bit lax about a few things and not taking it as seriously as you wanted them to. So when someone comes in and they say, you know, I run this little kind of enterprise on the side of the road. I'm repairing exhausts. I do this and that. And you say, and you said you earn this. Is that all? How do you know you earn this? How did you work that one out? You actually assist the person. So I'm thinking, if this goes and the person has signed it, you could ensure, look, you see what you've written here, my friend. Is this correct, or aren't, or are, you know, are you sure, or aren't you sure? You can clarify this, and I think that would be important, Honourable William.
Chapman, I don't think we should create the impression that people applying for debt relief should go to their constituency offices initially. So what we, I think that the way around this is the form of application, the actual application form. You know, that is where it must be spelled out. Not like how much debt you have, dot, 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 and then you just write a number in there. You know, it must be very similar to the applying for credit, you know, where you have to write down all of your expenses and everything. So it's the form that's going to start eliminating the mistakes. Because, you know, but if it says, do you currently earn any money in ABC, you know, whatever, how many jobs do you have, and you lie on that in particular, then you're in breach, and then perhaps it can be the maximum of 2 years sentence and the permanent, you're not allowed to apply for debt intervention again. I think it's the form, the application form, which is a very important tool in this whole process, that we don't know what that looks like yet, but, you know.
Problem with forms. There are very few people sitting here that can even complete their tax form without help. And that's the reality, even the ones with degrees. So I am saying not to go to your constituency office. I was merely pointing out how you have to work with such an applicant. But if they handed that form in and you come to the conclusion, no, this is, can't be true. The person is engaged to ensure that they've understood. And it's on that basis that you then say, no, look, we've tried to explain and help you, and you're still insisting on that. No. So you can get through that. And I do agree, there are many, many who misunderstand, misread a form when it's filled in.
Thanks, Chair. I wanted to just highlight that even when we think somebody has been misleading, it could be true that we were misled, but in hearings, you are able to distinguish evidentially whether this person was negligent or whether they were deliberate or whether they were mistaken. Because we all do make mistakes. We'll find that even in claims of executives, when they claim, they might make a mistake. So the idea is not necessarily to then hold them as criminals who are defrauding the system, but to correct it, to say, no, no, we don't agree with this, fix that, because you can tell that perhaps this is not deliberate. So I think the fear there can be alleviated just by the fact that you can evaluate using the evidence presented at the time. So that means case by case, you will find different circumstances and factors around it.
That's the point I'm making. So by that time, for sure you're going to know if someone's really trying to mislead you. So I think that's fair enough then. But I see from here Advocate van der Merwe, Honourable Williams, as the chair of the subcommittee and so on, that the rest are all to do with these penalties, etc. But there is one caution on, it's under 157B1 on the next page at the bottom, where a reference is made to determination of reckless lending. And where I think we've already said we ought to flag this, we've got to look into it again. Do you recall that? Do we agree? Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, are you saying that this committee must just go past all these other ones? Because I think that 57B1 at the top of the page that you're on is a credit provider who participates in unlawful credit marketing practices.
No. I'm saying the one that we won't deal with now is the reckless. Because, you know, we've dealt with that to some degree and we've taken a decision. So the rest we haven't really dealt with. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. If I could just respond to the questions that came out of that discussion. If a person applies for credit and they can afford the credit, but they lie on that, if there is an intention, so it is fraud because you have falsely indicated something. If there then is a prejudice to the credit provider, then you will be able to, the credit provider will be able to lay a charge of fraud against that consumer. So yes, there is a liability there. And in fact, just to confirm what the tribunal said, I think it is going to be very important, the whole application process, because if a consumer can show, but look, you asked me all of these questions and I've put everything there, and then a credit provider says, no, but you showed me this. The consumer can at that stage say, oh, I actually did not think of that. Yes, I agree that is correct. Then the process just goes ahead. The thing that we, and that is why we have the word intentionally very clearly in this offence. So the state, in other words, will have to prove that a person was deliberate in what they did. When they submitted the figures, when they submitted the names of credit providers, they were very intentional in leaving someone out. So I think that is covered. The next one, 157B, have a couple that runs together. It is about unlawful practices, where they do prohibited conduct and so on. So if we take each of them by themselves, the first one that we look at is a credit provider who participates in an unlawful credit market practice. Now, currently, the section that we're looking at would be 74, 75, and 91. Now, 91, there was already a comment. It refers to Section 90, and Section 90 is actually dealt with separately. So I agree Section 91 will be taken out there, otherwise it's a duplication. The current penalties is that the orders that this tribunal can make, so an administrative penalty already is there. The relevant contractual provision would be unlawful. It would be void. And in fact, the entire credit agreement may be declared unlawful. So the question then is, if we take into account that there can already be an administrative fine given and the entire credit agreement can be declared unlawful, does it mean that we need to also make this an offence? That's the first question. So does it have to be an offence? Does the person who did this also have to get a criminal record on top of an administrative fine and the whole agreement unlawful? And if so, is 10 years too long and the 10% of annual turnover, which is the same as administrative fine? So in fact, you could have both the administrative fine of 10 years and the criminal fine of 10 years, although a court will take into account that there was an administrative fine. So do we want it to be an offence, or is the current penalty sufficient? And if we say the current penalty is not sufficient, we want it to be an offence, is the 10 years too harsh?
Very clear to us. Honourable William?
Jefferson, with regard to this one, I think that we should say that it is an offence and that it is the 10 years and that the fine is exactly 10% of their annual turnover or R1 million, whichever is greater. We should accept all of those. I think that we have to start putting pressure on the credit providers so that they don't just give credit indiscriminately. I know they argue that they aren't doing that currently, but we do have an over-indebted society, and I keep referring to this, but it is a fact, and so those people must have got money from somewhere or credit from, you know, the credit providers. So I think we should make it quite harsh if they deviate outside of, you know, if they participate in unlawful credit marketing practices in this particular case. So I think we should include everything that's in the block, the third block or whatever it is. Thank you.
Fine. I know I'm thinking of something where it's so easy for a client to be bumbered and find him or herself with a, what do you call it, a criminal record. You know, what do you call it, petty sort of shoplifting or whatever, shoplifting. Now, it's not on the basis that what you picked up cost 10 cents or 1 rand. It is not on that at all. It is the principle. So you may find you've earned a criminal record because you took something worth 20 rand out of a shop. You can be 70, 80, or 18. You will get a criminal record. So we're going to lift that then. Shall we lift that? Shall we consider having that lifted? I personally think that is harsh. And I've had people who, in the spur of the moment, they mention they have done this, but, you know, deaths in the family and, you know, and all of this. Yes, they did. I don't know why I did it. But they're still going to get a criminal record. And I think let's just balance this out a little bit. Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, I think that we should adopt all of the fines and as it is on the document for the credit provider. You know, the next one is also the credit provider who does not comply with the limitations, etc., and the third one is a credit provider. So we should just keep going down those things and accepting those, that it's a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 10 years, or both a fine and an imprisonment, a convicted person, or a fine not exceeding 10% of its annual turnover. All of those things should be accepted all the way down when it's with regard to credit providers until we get...
We ought to
obviously, yes, excluding that, but until we get 57B2, I'm not sure what that is, but I think we should accept everything excluding the reckless lending until we get to the bottom of, I don't know what's... There's no slide numbers. Yeah.
From Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Kachalia, you can also comment if you wish.
I think he's very tired from his 3 a.m. flight this morning. Chair, you know, I think the important thing is to create consistency when it deals with offences. Now, I mean, you will know one of my pet peeves was the reduced fine that African Bank got for reckless lending. 300 million rand and then went down to 20 million rand. So any time that I've known where you can actually negotiate your sentence. But be that as it may, I don't. You know, I think that the penalties need to be in place, but they need to be. If it's a fine, it's a non-negotiable fine. It is either 10% or 1 million rand. That's it. It's not an open for negotiation thing, because what we can't have is bad behavior being rewarded through negotiations, and that's exactly what happened with African Bank. And in fact, they didn't change their behavior after that. They in fact doubled down on what they were doing, because they know that you could just, you know, incorporate a 20 million rand fine into your cost of business or cost of sales. So I don't know how that squares with the advocate in making sure that they are set non-negotiable fines.
I just want to hear you clearly. You used the African Bank as an example to illustrate the point you were making. But the point you are making is that you would like, you have no problem, but you would like to see this as not negotiable. Am I hearing you correctly? Yes, Advocate van der Merwe.
Chair, the fine of African Bank was an administrative fine, which is a bit different. A criminal fine, we cannot take this question away from the court. If you impose a maximum fine, it means that a court cannot take the personal circumstances of the person in front of them into account. And that, I think, would be against the rights of an accused. So because we are almost in saying that everyone has this. And it might be that you have someone who, the first time that they go to a client, they just opened their business, they go to a client, they do something wrong. That will be an offence. And to give that person a 10 years jail sentence is very harsh. Whereas if you have a company that sells, they don't do it anymore, but sells these encyclopedias. They've been doing it for years, and you have about 50 people who say that they have done the same marketing practices, or they didn't do the come to my house and didn't do the right thing. Then that would be a different circumstances before the court. So I would be very careful about taking the discretion away. I hear what you're saying about negotiation. I do think that is something that is much better monitored through oversight than through legislation, because you are taking certain discretions away.
Yes, I just want to come back to the shoplifting issue, because if you do that, you are recorded very much like a sexual offender. Now, the thing is, having been recorded, do you know what that means? It's very difficult to get a job in government if you can. You cannot. I think that's harsh. Yeah, these people can still get a job when they walk out. You are listed. You're a danger to society. And I don't think, if we're going to start talking about judicial consistency, let's get realistic here. Because up to now, very often, if you are impoverished, you pay a harsh penalty for being poor when you do the wrong thing. Now, I'm not suggesting we all go out and shoplift. I am saying that we need to make the punishment fit the crime. I'm not suggesting that we take away, which we can't, the discretion of the courts. We're not doing that, because we can't. Yes, DDG Masocha.
Thank you, Chair. I think for consumers, we should use the logic that you're applying to say that they're already in serious, dire situations, so the punishment for them must not be so harsh. But in terms of the credit providers, because of the damage they are doing to the market, because of the over-indebtedness we have in the country, I think the penalties must be harsh. And it might actually regulate the behavior. They might stop the conduct of what they're doing. Yeah.
Well, look, I must make it clear, because people do listen, as you say, Honourable MacPherson, we're not taking full decisions here. These are what are called deliberations, discussions. Honourable MacPherson?
Well, no, I'm well aware about the African Bank fine was an administrative fine, but I wanted to use that as a point as to how, you know, industry is allowed to get away with their behaviour because, you know, whoever is evaluating that penalty is not applying the maximum, force available to them, and that was really my point, advocates, is that the only way that you will stop people from giving reckless credit is when it affects their bottom line. If they know that they are going to lose that amount of money, or they are going to be severely fined for it, that is when they are going to actually stick to the rules. And that's the point that I wanted to make.
No, I do. I think we all do hear you, and you will recall, Honourable MacPherson, that many concurred in the committee with the issue that, you know, it was unfortunate that the NCR had alerted the SARB and many others about the slippery slope that African Bank was on, but it was beyond our mandate, per se. And I think this has made us very wary as we walk the road, because we don't want any form of penalty or admin action to actually encourage the wrong sort of commercial or business behavior. We cannot afford that. As Honorable MacPherson, certainly Honorable Williams, has stressed this often enough, it's not just about debt relief. It is not just about that. It is about reversing the South African culture of living on credit. I have never come across in my reading a country that has so indebted at not the poverty level, but at your middle income and higher. And the reason being the credit card. When people get credit cards, they actually assume that that's my money in the credit card, because they're able to spend up to 50 or 90. They seem to forget that it's a loan. It's a loan. And maybe the financial literacy has got to start doing something about it. People are even putting food on their credit cards. It's not acceptable. So I do believe we, if nobody else is going to do this, this committee needs to actually ensure that the culture begins to change in our country. Responsible lending takes place, and responsible borrowing and spending. It's a two-way street, not just one way. So if we can achieve that to some degree with this bill, that to me would be a great success in the country, if we can get somewhere along that road. But while we have finished with this for the moment, we have exhausted our deliberations, and it'll go back to the subcommittee. No, I sort of thought I was at the end. What else have I got?
Chairperson, on 57B2, it says any person who sells debt under a credit agreement to which this act applies. So now it's different from a company.
At it now, 157B2. All right, any person who sells a debt under a credit agreement. Right, that is a problem, the way debt is just sold. Right, Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. The next two, subsection 2 and 3, actually deals with prescription. Now, you will remember that we, in the previous amendments to the Credit Act, we brought in a specific section 126B that deals with prescription, because Consumers are not made aware of their rights in respect of prescription. They are fooled into acknowledging that they owe the debt, and then the debt simply is revived. So we dealt with it there. The problem is that there's no teeth other than prescription. So the it is prohibited conduct. So of course the orders that the NCT could make and an administrative fine do apply, and the debt itself is prescribed. But the NCR actually indicated that it's still a big problem, and perhaps the only way to deal with it is by making it an offence. It will be a very difficult offence to prove, because it's going to be a dispute. Is it prescribed? Isn't it prescribed? And there are so many factors that come into play when a court determines it. For instance, did the consumer acknowledge that they do owe the debt? So they picked up the phone, they said, no, I'm not going to talk to you anymore because you just harassed me. Is that an acknowledgement in itself, you know? It will be a factual dispute, there's no doubt about it. But on the other hand, if it is a problem, perhaps credit providers will be more careful about how they determine whether prescription has in fact occurred, make better notes of when they do talk to someone what the person actually said, etc., 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 because they know that if they did make a mistake, it would be an offense. So, yeah, but there is already the administrative fine and the debt that has prescribed. If we feel, look, it's going to be too uncertain to prove it in a court, maybe we shouldn't make it an offense. There is something.
What I would rather or prefer to do is to flag it. We have heard what you have to say, Advocate Vandermeer, but let's flag it, because yes, there are quite a number of these, and we need to deal with it, I think, more effectively than it is currently being dealt with. Do we agree? So we're flagging it. No? Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, now that I've got an understanding of that, and there was a thing, I think we should leave it as these 10 years and what it is, because it is a problem. We need to put a massive disincentive in place to stop these things from happening. So I would propose that we take it as the 10 years, the million rands, or the 10% of your turnover, because now I understand what is meant by that. I don't think we should flag this. I think it's clear that we need to disincentivize this practice.
All right, that's a view. Looking at the other two members sitting here, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Kecharia. Do you have a view on it? You've heard what was said? No. All right. Honourable McPherson. Oh, there we are. Honourable McPherson agrees with the position put forward by Honourable Williams. Right. So now we come to take us further, please.
Thank you, Chair. I think this is the last one. This one deals with registration offences. Now, this means if you, and this is the issue of the mashonisas out there. So if you are not registered as a credit provider, then it will be an offence. And I think my answer is already there. The others would be not registered as a debt counsellor, as whatever. The one concern that was raised is that the Act does not provide for a formal procedure for conciliation or mediation. So if an attorney, for instance, enters into that mediation process and they're not registered as an alternative dispute resolution agent, then they could be affected by this. So that could be a problem, or one person, I might be lending my daughter some money, and because I'm a very strict mother, I charge interest, and then that means that I'm committing a crime because I'm not registered as a credit provider, which is an unintended consequence. So perhaps it is simply to think about the unintended consequences and just make those possible as defences when we look at this. But I do think the sentiment that I've received from the committee so far is that failure to register should definitely be an offence, because we need you to be regulated by this act if you participate in the credit market. So it could simply be a matter of, I'm actually thinking that anyone who does not have a formal business of lending credit or being a debt counselor or that would be a suitable defense against this as a crime. MacPherson.
Thank you very much. I think that for me, this gets to one of the key principles I have with respect to this bill, and that's illegal lending.
Illegal.
Because those people have no form of recourse whatsoever. And I still think that the bill is short in offering those people recourse. So what we're just saying here is, Advocate, is that if you have a business that is not registered with the NCR, it is an offence to, with that possible sanction. And that's fine, but, I mean, I'm just not sure, you know, how do you determine what their turnover is? These guys don't exactly sort of, you know, keep a payroll system, you know, or, you know, sort of have a, you know, submit annual tax returns. So, I mean, I'm not sure that you're able to understand what their turnover is unless you can actually get hold of their physical book. And I think that's where we need to lean towards the stronger penalties of imprisonment. It should be a criminal offence to lend money to someone if you are not registered with the NCR. But it still falls short of what recourse does a person have who's borrowed money from them. I think we're still missing out on assisting those people, Advocate, and giving them recourse to have that debt extinguished in some way. And so I would just like some thought to be given and I'm not sure that this sanction, as you've proposed, is fitting to someone who keeps very little records about what their business is, you know, and trying to understand what their turnover is. And I think that we need to zero in on making that a criminal offence for lending money legally, but still taking note of how do we assist those people who actually have a debt with these people? How do we speak to them and not the lender?
But if they are illegal, as you've made it very clear, you're talking about illegal lenders, then they don't have to be paid a cent, not one cent. So it's already written off. It's already extinguished. It's gone. So there's no debt now.
Chairperson, with respect, that's nice to say in an air-conditioned room like this in Parliament. These are people that face, bodily harm. They have their IDs, held by these people. And I think that there has to be a mechanism that, you know, protects them in their application or their pursuit to have that debt extinguished, while at the same time disincentivizing those that are doing the illegal lending. So I don't think we can just simply say, well, you know, henceforth your debt is extinguished, because they will continuously be forced to pay that. And I think that it's always spoken to the lack of enforceability by the NCR to actually go after these people. I keep asking the NCR, how many people have been put in jail for illegal lending? I don't know of any, actually. The NCR have never come here and said that. So I think it would be important for us to look at how do we actually deal with that.
I know, but you can correct me, DDG and the NCR. The NCR works with the police on this. And it has been reported in this committee, the several raids conducted together with the police into where it is suspected and such illegal lenders are picked up. Now, what we can do is to ask the National Credit Regulator if they have at least a list of, I know there was something in Durban, there was Marikana, there was Gauteng, it's been in all of the provinces So have you got a list of the arrests made by the police?
Chairperson, we have a list, and it's many people that we reported to the police, but the crimes were for the retention of bank cards and IDs. Illegal lending currently is not a criminal offence. And that's why we support the proposal that it should be.
What did you say about the IDs?
The crimes that they committed were for keeping people's IDs and SASSA cards. The machinists were keeping the IDs. Yeah. Illegal lending currently is not a criminal offence. What we would do is we will issue compliance notices for them to stop and then take their loans also to the tribunal to declare them unlawful. But we support the proposal to criminalize illegal lending.
What you're saying is it isn't criminalized at the moment and you support the proposal. Honorable McPherson?
And that's why my point was, is that no one has been prosecuted because you can't be prosecuted. So I mean, I said no one's been sent to jail, and that is a fact. And you said that they had been. So, and that's why we need to be able to protect both parties. And I'm concerned that there is still not that protection for people that have been lent money. To remedy their situation.
Williams before.
Chairperson, I propose that we put a clause in here that says illegal lending of money is a criminal offence and you'll go to prison for 20 years and or the fine will be 20 million rands or what the maximum. We go for hardcore maximum sentences on that. And we just add a clause into our amendment because that will hopefully be able to put those people that were raided and given these orders, actually put them in prison. Thank you.
Yes, there have been people put in prison, but I think it is because they have pulled a weapon during the process. And so it's quite right that it may have not have been specifically, illegal lending, but because to get their money back, they pulled a weapon on someone. So I think, yes, the point is we should actually criminalise it. Let me have a look at you then now. Honourable McPherson, Honourable Kachalia, Honourable Williams, are you saying, yes, it should be criminalised, illegal lending? Are we agreeing?
Proposed by the Honourable Williams, seconded by the Honourable McPherson.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable. So, we've got that far. We haven't got as far as to agree on the penalty. Am I correct? That's where we are at the moment. We've agreed it should be criminalised. Right. The only thing that does worry me, given the gangsterish sort of nature of these folk, is that while that arrest is taking place, we need to ensure that they're removed from the location that they're in. There should be no bail. They should actually go and sit in a police cell until it goes to court. Until. The mere fact that you have been doing something illegally, we've already said is a crime. We're just not sure of the degree of the crime. But that may be against our, maybe against the judicial legal system not to give gangsters bail. No wonder they're still walking our streets. Yes, Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. If a person who is not registered and is giving loans is arrested, yes, that person has a right to bail. But the court will give conditions. You're not allowed to commit this crime again. So if that person goes back, yes, unfortunately, that person might be able to get bail. But if they do go back and they continue their business, then they will be arrested again, and their chances of getting bail then is really, really very low.
Revoked. The bail will be revoked because the conditions have not been complied with. There was one other point, members, I wanted to raise, which was reported to me about a year ago, and that was by a pensioner him and his wife, you know, they were very good parents, and they did think their children had assimilated their values. So they thought, well, we're in our 70s, you know, we've got this little place on the senior citizens' sort of homes or whatever, and we now want to help our son and daughter-in-law establish a business. Let's just give this over to them. And they gave over all of their savings, all of it. But there was a proviso that after a year, the son would repay 20% or 25%. Very little, very little. Do you see that? I forget the millions it was, but only had to repay 25%. After a year, no one could find him at all. And he hasn't visited his parents for 4 months. And, you know, there it is. That was, he was, you know, he, the parent gave the son this, but the proviso being, please repay 25%. All the family members knew of this. And it wasn't an illegal document. And they were told there was nothing they could that could be done legally. As a, you know, consequent to that, the father had a heart attack and died shortly afterwards, and the mother died within 7 months. So, you know, I've never forgotten that case that was brought to my attention. And, yes, so that was an illegal lending, if you like, and no protection. But I would agree that our legislation cannot carry deal with every eventuality. That is part of the problem. But there is something that we ought to be able to note in that regard. What can be done to advise pensioners of this challenge? So it's not just that you have to think of financial literacy for those who are under 60, shall we say, but there is a need to give such literacy to those over 60 years of age so that they don't find themselves in that unfortunate position. So am I correct that we may have come to the end of this? And at which point I can just deal... Yes, DDG?
Sorry, Chair, not to interrupt the program. There's a matter that came up this week regarding, there's a matter that came up about debt counselors who are abusing our process. They're sending messages out there that they can rearrange debts for consumers at very low rates. I'll request Mr. Kumkani just to elaborate on this.
Thank you.
Thanks, DDG. Thanks, Chair. Just quickly, I think after the committee has embarked on this particular process of debt intervention, there are consumers who have actually been receiving calls from debt counselors, in particular from the Western Cape, offering them to have their charges and interest on loans without actually indicating to them that, look, you are entering into a debt review process. So some of the consumers would perhaps, when they approach their banks, find that it reflects that they are actually under debt review, therefore they cannot access credit. You know, this has got sort of far-reaching implications for this process, because 2 years later, when we finalize this process, some research would sort of suggest that this process was just, you know, one of the processes, in the sense that many people are trapped under debt review, whether with their knowledge or without their knowledge. But some of the complaints that we have since referred them to the NCR for investigation. But it's something that has actually, you know, been brought to our attention, and then the consumers were not even aware that, you know, when they are called, you know, the implication is that you actually now applying for a debt review, and when you want to access credit, then it becomes a difficulty. Not that you cannot afford, but the fact that there's an indication on your record that you are currently applying for debt review, it then the system kicks you out, you know. Yeah. So it's something that we.
Thank you very much, DDG, for that. And I do think this has been a very constructive engagement, and I hope members have considered it such, including those who must well be exhausted due to delayed flights and so on. I am sorry, but thankful that you are here. Members, for a moment in time, and thank you, Advocate van der Merwe. I know you've done a lot of work on crafting this, and it is really appreciated. But if you would just stay in your seats while we deal with this so that there's no disturbance. Mr. Hermans handed out a program. I think you've all got it. And as far as I can see, the only amendment Mr. Hermans referred to was the timing on Friday the 23rd, which should have said 12:30 or so. It's the subcommittee on copyright on the 23rd. Doesn't affect the whole committee. When it comes to the 28th, the 28th is a long-standing arrangement with the Finance Standing Committee on the date, the 28th of March. We've had it for 6 weeks. And it is about Steinhoff, the Steinhoff matter. This is directly under our mandate as well because it deals with companies, and there appears to have been a flouting of the Companies Act, and Advocate Foller will be in attendance. And as this is our mandate, it is important that we do attend, many of us, for as long as possible. It is a joint meeting, not a casual meeting. However, the challenge which was brought to my attention in tea break, that is the 28th of March, a long-standing arrangement. The one that was brought to my attention in tea is that, and perhaps you can talk to it, Mr. Hermans.
Chair, there was a request for a joint meeting with more than three or four committees on the listeriosis matter. I think the Committee on Agriculture has scheduled a meeting on the 28th of March, which directly conflict with the Steinhoff meeting. I'm not so sure they end up inviting all committees that were supposed to do that. And as I indicated, it will be the chairperson who will have to discuss the matter with the other chairpersons to find the resolution to the matter.
Yes, so I said my immediate action will be to telephonically engage the other chairpersons in this regard, and the proposal I will make, and that is what is important to members, is that the 27th would probably remain as is, but on the 28th there, the finance remains, and then we've got the 29th copyright. We can take the copyright off. The challenge is three or four committees are unlikely to agree to meeting the day before the Easter weekend. Do you hear what I'm saying? So we may have to look at Tuesday. So I would like to put forward Tuesday the 27th of March to them. Do you hear? Yes, Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, that's fine. But if they don't agree with that, is it not possible to split our committee and send some people there and some people, you know what I mean? Because we already split for subcommittees, so it shouldn't be...
No, that was the other proposal Mr. Hermans made. The first proposal is shift the whole meeting. Do we agree? If that is not accommodated, for whatever the reason, then we will split, and we will split this down very much in a matter in which, say, you know, at least three will attend this and three the other, and hopefully four. But I think we really only have how many members? Oh, no, it's 10, isn't it? but that includes what are called casuals, casual members. So we will adopt either or, but I will let you have that decision on Tuesday the 23rd. Isn't that right? The 20th. Tuesday the 20th. Are we in agreement? Right. The other issue which we bring to your attention is the Mr. Hermans is busy compiling and putting together the study visit overseas, the application. And what is likely to be accepted without a problem will be that we at least do one study visit and remain fixed to probably Britain if it's on debt or Germany or something. But it is not going to be acceptable, probably, I'm saying the word probably, for us to wander around Europe, as it were. So it's a pity others aren't present here today, but I need to tell everyone that the copyright, we will probably invite the people here as we did 6 years ago when we did the intellectual property, and they sent their top people over here for a week. And so what we will be pursuing is the debt, absolutely, but not just debt. We will be pursuing the fourth industrial revolution, and that's why others may join us. Do you follow? So that doesn't require an agreement, because I know you all would like us to embark on a study visit. It does require Mr. Froelich's agreement. Having looked at the number of committees that are away at that particular time, he may well offer us an alternate time. And secondly, I doubt that we will once again experience a financial constraint, as we will be in the second month of the financial year. So members, please get home safely, go to your families, and meeting adjourned until Tuesday at 9. Thanks. Okay.